Very good. Thank you.
Where's Jeff Miller? He's not here. Is he late?
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm going to ask everyone if you could please stand, and we're going to start the meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance.
To the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. At this point, we have actually, between the last meeting and this meeting, five new members to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. And what I'd like to do is maybe just go around. If I can ask actually both the new members and as well as the existing members, just quickly just introduce yourselves, because this is the team for the next, at least for the next year. And so I'm going to start.
Yes, Hollis Ellis from Hampton Roads, at-large position, replacing Dana Dickens, a professional engineer on consulting firm, civil engineering consulting.
Gary Garzinski, at-large appointee, Northern Virginia real estate developer.
Jim Davis, Stanton District.
Dana Martin, Salem District.
Jim Bowie, Bristol District.
Jerry McCarthy, Richmond District.
Of course, I'm Sean Cadott, the Secretary of Transportation and Chairman.
Thelma Drake, Director of Department of Rail and Public Transportation.
James Keene, Rural at Large.
Doug Coulomay, Northern Virginia District.
Aubrey Lane, Hampton Roads District Representative.
And Mark Peake, I'm the Lynchburg District Representative.
Alan Lauterbach, Rural Representative at Large.
Excellent. Well, welcome to all new members, as well as welcome back to all our existing members. We have, obviously, our work session this morning and then the meeting right afterwards. I am going to try to push this meeting as quickly along as possible. All the new members have to undergo ethics training, and that will be undertaken immediately following our work or business session. So we're going to try to move this meeting as quickly as possible, because that session is going to take at least a couple of hours to go through with you all. And so I think Joanne Maxwell here from the Attorney General's office is going to conduct that. Before we actually get into the work session, I just want to, where is Charlie Kilpatrick? Charlie, come up here. I want to introduce our deputy commissioner, who just came on board, I think, between the two meetings. And Charlie, can just maybe tell folks a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you, hon. Good morning. I'm Charlie Kilpatrick. I have been here a month now. This is my second tour with VDOT. I was with VDOT from 94 to 2004. In Fredericksburg as an assistant and then resident engineer, so I do have some background understanding the workings of the organization, especially as it relates to field operations. I'm glad to be back. It does feel like coming home to me, and I look forward to working with all of you. One of my primary responsibilities will be the nine field districts, working with district administrators on issues in the field, as well as working on some of the mega projects through the PPTA office. Thank you.
Charlie, welcome. You're doing a great job. He's only been on board a month. The commissioners keep him very, very busy.
Isn't that right?
That's right.
Excellent. All right, with that, we're going to get right into our first session, first item. That's an update on the federal strategy, bonus application authority, and ARRA. We have Rita Buescher.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we want to give you as close to the end of the federal fiscal year update as we can on the federal strategy, the bonus obligation authority, and the ARRA projects. The federal strategy is VDOT's plan for obligating federal funds to our obligation authority level. That's the level that the federal government allows us to commit funding for reimbursement on projects in any given year. It includes financial transactions such as project modifications, conversions, and transfers as well as obligating project phases. Now, the deadline for transactions to meet this annual obligation authority is September 27th, 2010, so just around the corner. Funds that are not obligated by states are withdrawn and redistributed to states, and we just received our bonus OA obligation authority level, and I'll speak to that in a moment. So basically those states that are successful in obligating their federal funds, such as Virginia, are eligible to receive bonus obligation authority. This is a summary of where we started for the federal fiscal year 2010 federal strategy. Our initial obligation authority, which we call OA, was at $861.5 million. Now, after adjustments and transfers, for example, during the year, we transfer funds to the Federal Transit Authority, and we also, some of that money includes RSTP and CMAQ projects that are to be administered by the FTA. And there were funds for the Dulles extension and funding that was STP funding flexed for DRPT. Other items that have reduced that amount down to the $761 million level were transfer of funds for projects to Eastern Federal Lands and that sort of thing. So it whittles itself down depending on the funding, who's going to manage the project, and the project type. So as of yesterday, we were obligated up to $756.4 million out of the $761.2, and the balance is already submitted to FHWA for their approval at $4.8 million. So basically, our work is done on this portion. Now, what we just received notice on is bonus OA. We had submitted project requests indicating we could handle another $52 million in projects if we were to receive a bonus OA in the amount of $52.8 million. Now, this bonus OA allocation has to be obligated in Federal Fiscal 10 as a boost to this year's federal strategy. We're restricted to use the available funding categories or apportionment that we have available to us currently. The projects need to be in the current six-year improvement program, and the project phases must already must be included in a SIP or a TIP. Now, on September 13th, we received notification, that's last Friday, that we would receive $42.2 million as a result of the bonus OA or the redistribution. We are currently reviewing our apportionment or our available funding levels, funding categories, to see if we can match up the projects that we've identified for this additional bonus OA and make sure we have the apportionment or the funding type that matches those projects. And we have about $70 million worth of projects identified. We actually have more than the 50 that we submitted. So, and the reason being, this bonus OA has to be obligated also by September 27th. So short turnaround time, we're prepared, and we have projects that we're currently identifying or currently choosing from.
Special, before you leave that, I'm sorry, this is the good news, but the bad news is, you know, they took away, we had a rescission as well. Is that correct?
They did.
So
they did earlier. The rescission. I think that's right.
So on one hand, they took away $56 million.
On
the other
hand,
they turned around and gave us back this
bonus OA, yeah.
So.
Actually not. They did not increase the apportionment, but they bonus OA. So kind of a paper shuffle. Okay. To give you an update on ARA, this is another effort that we've been working on for a couple of years. As you know, the deadline for finally obligating ARA funds is also September 27th.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, what was the reason for the rescission of those loans?
To pay for teachers' salaries.
That's not
and, fire, and firefighters, too, on the local level.
Okay. So other uses.
That is how they kept it, quote unquote, budget neutral, was to take away authority from us, from the education funds, I think, for the race to the top, and other accounts. And so we're they took $2.2 billion completely out of the Federal Highway Administration.
The ARRA update, again, the ARRA funds remaining need to be obligated by September 27th. What we've experienced, as you all know, and we've been monitoring and planning for, has been that project awards less than the engineer's estimates had created project savings that we had to actually move to other qualifying projects, get them reobligated, advertised, and awarded to get to this point. So it's been quite a quite an effort and a money shuffle, if you will. We are continuing on in two MPOs to remove contingency funding from projects for use on other eligible projects, and I'll show you in a moment. I believe that's Nova and Hampton Roads. At this time, in terms of the projects that needed to be obligated or the funding for the CTB, we are completely obligated. We are, or I should say, we've submitted everything. We're waiting on one project to be approved by FHWA, and that's a contingency project on 581 Elm Avenue, and that's pending at FHWA. The other contingency projects up here that you see have been approved. Courthouse was just approved this week. The summation for the MPOs, and for those new board members, the CTB received a portion of the fund ARRA allocation, and the MPOs, the five large MPOs, received about $117 million that they had to obligate as well. NOVA still has a $1.47 million out of the 18 projects they identified that needs to be reobligated, and we have projects identified, and we are working to make that happen, and it will happen by the 27th. Fredericksburg is complete, Richmond is complete, Tri-Cities is complete, and we have about $2 million in Hampton Roads that we're moving, unobligating and reobligating on new projects. So we're down to about $2 million in Hampton out of their $41 million. In a nutshell, that's where we are.
Okay, so are we going to make it for Hampton Roads and Nova?
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, let's go ahead.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. In terms of the allocation of those additional unobligated balances in Northern Virginia, are you working from a priority list from local governments or from the district administrator's office, or is that something that's, when you said identified, is that identified here?
You mean for the MPOs?
Yeah.
The MPOs identified some contingency projects.
Okay.
Initially, we were only looking at contingency projects in the amount in case a project didn't make it to the point of being ready for advertisement. Then we actually went back, and because the bids, again, were coming in so good, and wanted to make sure that since some of those projects weren't at that stage to know what the awards were going to be, we asked them to remove, we were doing the same thing on the VDOT side, remove any contingency that they had placed on the project originally, which is a standard procedure in a construction project, to look at removing that contingency and come up with projects to put that money on. So we had to deobligate and then reobligate. So we are down to the final project selections by the localities because the MPOs sub-allocated our funding to localities. And we're working with those localities and the MPOs to finalize these last few transactions.
Chairman.
Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Garza.
Will we be given access to what those final awards were for NOVA and I guess
Hampton
Roads too?
shortly.
Because I mean, it's got to be relatively small. $1.4 million doesn't go a long way in making improvements these days. I get you traffic.
Yes, we can provide that. Absolutely. Okay,
thank you.
1.5 traffic lights. Any other questions? Ms. Buescher, thank you very much. Go to revenue sharing program. Mr. Esty from VDOT.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While this is loading up, I just thought for the benefit of the new board members, I would introduce myself as the gentleman who's consuming way too much maybe of your workshop this morning, but Mike Estes, and I report to Chief Rick Walton, who's the Chief of Policy and the Environment. And our small shop and central office is basically, in a nutshell, oversees special funding programs for local governments and special policies that are created statewide to assist and partner with local governments. So today's workshop is a good cross-section of what we cover in our shop, and although there may be some small programs in there, as some of the current board members will tell you, they'll consume a lot of your time and a lot of interest from your constituents. So very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to walk through the revenue sharing update, and this is basically an update or an overview of the final applications that came in after the June update to the board. The applications were due right after the last June board meeting. A real quick overview of the program is it is a state-funded program that provides matching funds from the state to funds provided by local governments. A lot of the discussion of the board has been over the current allocation level of $15 million, and you'll see that the requests have far outweighed the $15 million available. In past years, we've been able to fund that up to about $50 million the last couple of years, and we're at $15 currently. It is open up to all the counties as well as the 81 cities and towns around the Commonwealth that operate and maintain their infrastructure, and they are allowed to apply for up to $1 million, and you'll learn a little bit more about the tiered approach a little later. From an application standpoint, this slide just simply summarizes the number of applications we received across the state. You can see the number of localities that requested dollars, and you can see that this year's allocation request was around $37 million in state matching funds against the $15 million available. This will be the recommendation that the board will consider at its formal action meeting on the allocations for these projects. And the basic takeaway from this slide is for the $15 million, the tiered approach is set out in law on the prioritization of where the money can go to projects, with tier one being for those projects that the locality is willing to administer themselves. So those you can see represented about $32 million of the $37 million in requests. Therefore, the local governments who are going to receive funds are going to receive around 46% of what they asked for, to be a good example. And when you get to the action meeting, there's going to be several tables at the back of the revenue sharing item that will detail not only the allocated amounts that the board will be hopefully approving, but also there's a full listing so you have a good overview of every project and every locality that asked for funds, and you can see the projects as well that did not get funds. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that was my quick overview of revenue sharing.
Any questions? Ms. Estes, I have more of a comment, and this is for the commissioner and just generally about process. You know, this is revenue sharing is a great program. I mean, it's for every dollar we put in, we get $2 worth of improvements. And you know, we're in some ways, we end up making decisions in a vacuum, in that we set up a number, not knowing what the number of projects are going to come in, and how much the request is going to be. I'd like to see us actually go out and get from the localities, you know, set a new date for actually them submitting their applications, so that before we actually adopt the six-year plan, we can know how much money that, or we should be allocating potentially to it. I know we had a lot of discussions over the last several months as we didn't know how many applications we were going to get, and so we set a number of $15 million. I think it's going to be would work a lot better for us if we got them to apply first, and then when we're doing the six-year plan and the updates to it, that we could actually see how much is being requested, how many actually of the applications were valid, and then a budget according to it. Is that a problem?
Mr. Chairman, no, we can easily do that. We can put out a call for a tentative look from the local governments. I think they would welcome the opportunity. I think we can also kind of pair that with historic data and give a pretty good indication of how much money they would request.
Yeah. You know, it's particularly for, as I've gotten sensitive to, let me say I've gotten beat over the head over it, as I've gone out and about and met with localities, given, you know, the situation, whether for secondary roads or whatever, for construction, for a lot of localities, this is the only way they can get things done. And so they're willing to put money up. The problem is that, you know, they just see our pot on revenue sharing getting smaller, to which, you know, and I appreciate the work that you and your folks put into this. I mean, we were guesstimating as to how much money to set aside, given that the program goes up and down. So if we were to be able to, you know, get this much earlier in our update process, you know, maybe even, I'm saying January or February of next year, as for the applications, and then you can look through and come make a recommendation to us during the six-year plan. Because, again, for it's stupid for us not to be taking advantage of $2 worth of improvements for $1 from the state.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Keene.
I think that's an excellent idea. As I travel around and visit and get involved in projects in the rural sections, this is the number one concern from the county board supervisors, as well as the towns in those areas that see this as one of their only source of income in some cases. So I think this is an excellent idea.
So do you need anything from the board to actually do that, or you just...
I have all I need, sir.
Excellent, Mr. Essie. Thank you very much.
move on
again for enhancement program, right?
All right, this one's a little bit longer, Mr. Chairman. I'll spend a few minutes on this. This, again, for our today, the first PowerPoint was for revenue sharing, and in the last PowerPoint, our Columbia Pike will be things for consideration for action in the action meeting. The next two PowerPoints are going to be discussions around CTB policy for some of the local programs. We spend a lot of time at this board on enhancement program. It's only a $15 to $20 million a year program. But again, it does tend to consume a good bit of your time and attention as board members. Most of you are going to be aware of the program regardless, but just a few first slides are just to give an overview of what the program is. A lot of times, our biggest thing to remind folks is it's mandatory set-aside from the Federal Highway Administration. We have to use this money for these type of purposes or we lose the money. So that's the big takeaway from the first slide. And then we'll go through some of the policies that are in place currently for the CTB. But there's 12 eligible categories under the federal program. Basically, the current policy, we look at all eligible projects through FY13. We'll talk about that in a minute. We score the applications that come in. And then two of the newer policy changes were the board must fund a minimum of 50% of the requested amount and the full amount if it's less than $200,000 that the applicant asked for. I'm not going to spend any time on this. It's just for we need to go back to the 12 categories that are eligible. We can talk about those if need be. I want to put in kind of frame last year's discussion that came. We spent a lot of time in front of the board starting last June talking about the policy and some suggested changes from staff. And this was what I would call the problem statement that I brought to the board last June. This basically talks about, in a nutshell, the number of projects that the board's allocated money to, and the percentage of expenditures that we've been able to draw down as a Commonwealth, and where we, quite frankly, lag behind other states in the country on drawing down those expenditures. So this was our goals that we presented to the board last June. Those are self-explanatory as to what we hope to accomplish through the policy discussion. And then in November, basically we brought the policy discussion in June. We did a survey of the individual board members. We came up with a survey of what, with several ideas that we floated through the board and got personal feedback from each board member. We also went out to the public and talked a little bit about some of the proposed changes, and we came back, and this is what the board adopted. The increase used to be the board only had to apply 25% of the funding requests. Now it's up to 50%. Again, the $200,000 I mentioned earlier was put in place. That was put into effect immediately in November. We also asked the board, and the board approved our request that we limit applications for FY12 to only those projects that are in the system, existing projects, with the intent to try to get projects off the shelf, off the list, get them done, that were partially funded. We also had a lot of discussion on those 12 eligible categories. The initial staff recommendation was to limit it to pedestrian, bicycle, corridor improvement, streetscape type work, and then through the dialogue, we expanded it to the other two categories you see here, and we'll talk about that again a little bit later. So what this is that was the policy discussion, and I've talked to quite a few members about what that was able to do for us, and this was what we talked about in June as the success from the policy perspective. Basically, I'm going to show you another table that you have for your use in your PowerPoint that talks about the last 10 years. The big takeaway is that out of all the projects that we funded as a board, you funded 74% of the requests. 74% of the requests that you funded were fully funded at phase of that project. Huge move in what I consider the right direction. You'll see that compared to previous years. So that's putting, from the board's perspective, the policy in place and the money in place to get the projects done. Quite frankly, I've talked with some board members. I've talked to Mr. Keene quite a bit about the project development side. And rightfully so, I think Mr. Keene has brought to attention. We've changed some things on the policy. Now let's see, are you carrying forward VDOT from a program management, project management perspective to turn around? We put the needed funds on the projects, are you able to turn those projects around now when the locals start bringing those in from plan reviews, getting them out on the street, working with them and partnering with them? So that's kind of our two-pronged approach that we've been putting in place on the program management side. And this is the chart, again, that highlights where we've been since 2000. And I think, again, the takeaway is that 74% number was fully funded versus the 10-year average of only 41%. Again, applaud the board for taking that on last year. An emphasis on where we're going with the next cycle. Applications are due in December. You'll be approached quite a bit on that between now and December. And we are asking that, or we are standing with taking only applications for existing projects only for this 1 year. We have sent out almost 300 letters to existing project sponsors already, letting them know the deadline, letting them know the expectation that they need to communicate back to us and back to the board what their anticipation is on finishing the project. They need to let us know what their final estimates are going to be, what they're looking for allocations to get these projects to fruition. On the tail of that, one of the things that I'll be emailing out to all the board members, and those who have been here since last year have this already, but we'll give you an updated one. We have district status sheets for every enhancement project since 1993 that's been allocated funds in your district. And for the at-large members, I'll send you the whole state, or you can tell me specifically which districts you'd like to see. But I'll email you a status report, and it'll give you the allocations by year and the current status, whether it's under agreement, all the way to under construction or complete. And then that'll give you a better picture when the sponsors start approaching you for the allocation requests from now to December. And what that also does is, I'm proud to say a lot of the board members will actively take that, engage the sponsors who look like they've been having some money for quite some time, and try to reach out and find out, well, what's the issue? And what that may mean is we cancel some of those projects. We've got a very aggressive deallocation process where we cancel projects that aren't moving, that aren't meeting the board's timeframes that are set in CTV policy, and that'll free up additional money for new or other existing projects. Very complex, multidimensional approach that we're taking on this, and I'd be happy to speak with you individually on that once I get you those status sheets out. So I'll get with Carol and get those to you shortly. The next thing I want to talk about is...
I'm sorry, before you leave that. So, okay. I mean, your general overall recommendation is no new money, no new projects try to finish off the projects we have, so that at least for 1 year, so that we can get, because even what we did this year, where are we? Are we still at 56%?
We are. I checked the number yesterday. We're at about 60%, so we're inching up. We'll take a movement in the positive direction. But we think there's definite room that with 1 year, of only existing projects receiving funds will not address all the what we call the shortfall between what the latest estimate we may have from a locality or a sponsor versus the allocation they have. But it'll at least put an attempt to put a little dent in that.
Mr. Chairman?
But because we have maybe the potential for new projects, all right, because I know some members would like to, if the members go out and start to talk to some of the applicants and finds out that the project is not moving forward, what would happen if we were then to come back and say, okay, this project's not moving forward, I'd like to shift it to another project, either an existing project or to a new project?
Mr. Chairman, we have a formal we call it a deallocation process. It's either when a project's finished or when a project is canceled. It goes through, there's a formal process that can go through to move it to an existing project. So that would be something we would work with the individual district board representatives on to move it to existing projects.
But let's just say then we have a new project. All I'm raising this is that I know there are new potential applications and applicants out there, some of them very viable, that if a district member was to go and identify essentially deallocating certain projects in order then to shift to one that is viable, how difficult would that be to do?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, the Commonwealth Transportation Board has quite a little bit of liberty on how we administer this program.
How miserable are we going to make your life?
But it will, quite frankly, to answer your question directly, we've communicated to all 300 folks and we've communicated to all local government that we're accepting existing applications or applications for existing projects only.
Okay.
So I think if you start to open it up to one or two, we may open ourselves up to criticism for the broader audience, would be my point.
That's good. Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, or Michael, I wanted to ask you, being a novice, who can be sponsors? It's not just county, cities, and towns. It's private organizations or...
Yeah, Mr. Estes, can you just maybe, for the five new members, just give a brief overview of the whole program?
I can try. yes, sir. Basically, it's a 10% set aside, $15 to $20 million a year. It's federal money. So it comes with the federal strings. It's application-based. We do a pretty aggressive outreach from applicant workshops, typically on an annual basis. They go and they put in applications to us in December. We have a scoring committee that takes a variety of different folks from different representative areas, scores the applications based on a scoring sheet approved by this board. We give you the scores. We also give you a status on existing projects to show you kind of a priority of how they're moving. So if it's an existing project, we've already scored it, but we'll say it's almost ready for construction or it's still in engineering, that type of thing. We'll work with the board over the spring. Typically, we work with the district members first, and they'll get a cut at selecting projects. We'll share that with the full board. The at-large members will come in with some recommendations for hopefully to fill in the gaps that maybe they're still existing. That the board members, the district members weren't able to fill. And it takes from there all the way, it kind of joins and partners with our six-year planning process, goes out for public involvement, and at the end of the day, in June, the board will approve allocations to the projects. We then carry those into agreements with the sponsors. Typically, the agreements are going to be with local governments. I would say 90% of the projects are sponsored by local governments, so it would be the county or cities. On occasion, we'll do an agreement directly with the Civil War Preservation Trust, another nonprofit. But quite frankly, a lot of times, like a Fairfax County may sponsor it, but it may be that the Park Authority is running it, or maybe another nonprofit who is really taking charge of kind of spearheading the program from a grassroots, or the project from a grassroots initiative to get through the process.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think you may have a good thing there about maybe possibly doing some new ones if the existing ones don't pan out. And I think we might want to consider that. Would we have to amend the pending or the current resolution to provide for that, or would that be taken care of anyway under the current language? Or would you need some kind of a motion to allow for new ones if the other ones don't pan out?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rich, the policy that was adopted by the board in November did specifically write into that policy no new applications for FY12.
You would have
to take action as a board to amend the policy.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I've worked extensively with Mike in this category in some areas that we've had in certain sections of rural Virginia. I think at this stage of the game, we would be so late that it wouldn't be good to look at new projects for this year. And I'd have to commend Mike for his diligence in digging and looking at these existing projects that we've been criticized on. And I've done some work as well with the locals. And I find that once we mention deallocation, this is looking close. Then these people begin to kick these projects into high gear, because it is locally administered. It's not something that VDOT administers. And quite frankly, we have to hold their hand and guide them along to help them meet these guidelines as they come into compliance to get these projects under construction. So there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work. And I think we're moving in the right direction here. I believe the project is going to be really aggressive in applying these monies that we've been criticized, that we've been holding. And I think we'll see an improvement here. And through what I hear is happening from Mike in terms of reporting, in terms of following up on these projects, I think we're going to see a good improvement in this performance in the next short period of time. And I commend Mike for that. I've been a little rough on him at times, but we've examined a lot of the rural Virginia projects, and I'm getting a pretty good level of satisfaction with what I'm seeing happening internally.
Do we ever have any money just that has to be laid over to next time because it wasn't used by the existing projects because of they couldn't get their act together?
Well, yeah. I mean, okay. Right now we're only at 50.
60.
Now we're up to only 60% of the money that we have actually been given in this
program. So we don't want to lose it. If there's a viable new project, I think maybe.
Well, I think that's what the issue really is because money has been allocated to projects throughout the state, many of them have not moved forward. So what Mr. Estes is trying to do is either, you know, shake the tree, see if they really are going to happen. If not, we'll sweep the money back. So he's trying to get, one of the reasons for this, I'm going to call it 1 year moratorium, is that I hate to say this is a 1 year grace period. And then we'll start to probably deallocate a lot of money and then start to go back out for new projects next year.
Do we lose that money, Mr. Chairman?
What's that?
Do we lose that money if it's not out?
No, it carries over. I mean, that's where when we say 60%, how much money have we? Oh, I mean, it's actually in the chart here. So we have had for this program $190 million. $190.6 million, of which, and that's all been quote unquote allocated. However, just doing my math, we probably have only spent $120 million of it. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, Mr. Richard, do you have anything?
No.
Yeah. So I mean, so it carries over. So this is not money that dies by fiscal year.
The only thing I would mention on that is, not to get too far in the weeds, but you know, as you're fully aware, you know, the Federal Highway Administration puts these on their reports for inactivity and makes us then document that we're moving these forwards or have a good plan as to how we're going to use the money. So it does become in jeopardy if it sits too long, and that's part of the plan is to try to shake the tree, as you said, and either get them moving or get them moved off the projects. And our anticipation would be, if I get the board those status sheets, you can see for yourself the projects. We can work collectively together, approach those sponsors and see if they're truly going to move those projects or not. And then through the next year's allocation, you're going to see, I would say, a substantial spike in available allocations to put towards other existing or new projects.
Yeah, because I think we have to be a little more stricter. It's our pool money. I just, if they're not going to move the project forward, Mr. Lane, thank you.
Yeah, I recall also we upped the percentage that we would match from 25 to 50%, and because that was stalling some of these projects. We were taking too long. So I know in our district, put it on projects between that upper match and also the deallocation, I'm starting to see things moving on it. So I think I'll just sort of second what Mr. Keene said, is that we've sort of shaken the tree, and to give it a year, I think we'll see a significant increase.
Mr. McCarthy?
Just one technical question, Mike. 15 to 20 million a year represents 10% of what exactly?
Rita might have to help me, but it's basically the statewide surface transportation program federal money that comes to the state.
But we get a lot more than 150 million.
That's just that one category of federal dollars. The total, all the categories of federal money that comes to the state is much, much greater than that, yes.
Okay, because I have occasionally had people saying, why are you spending 10% of all that federal money on this stuff? And I'm saying, well, I don't believe that's the case. It's by law, a certain amount, but I've never quite understood what it was 10% of. So thank you.
Sure. Mr. Carson?
Mike, another question for you. How much have we deallocated over this 10-year period? Just so I get a feel for it.
Deallocation, Mr. Grzynski, is somewhat of a new child of us for the last 3 years. Over the last 3 years, I have the number in the book, but I think it's around $8 million, round number.
Okay, so it's not a terrible large amount. Now, as you shake the tree, as you called it, do you plan to have fixed criteria that deallocates? I only ask this question, Mr. Chairman, because in the Federal Home Loan Bank system, we have an affordable housing program that gets 10% of the profits of the banks, and they give them to sponsors. Mm-hmm. And we have the same problem. Things don't get done that were supposed to get done, and we had to go to a fixed criteria. And if you didn't make it, there wasn't a whole lot of leeway. I mean, you got deallocated, and that's what it came down to finally move people. So I just offer that.
And I'd say, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Grzynski, what we'll do is our plan, and you'll see here in just a minute, is to come back next month with a suggested policy change, and we'll take a red line markup of the current CT policy, and we'll show you what our proposal is. And within that policy is a 4-year time limit that the locals or the sponsors has to draw that money down. Quite frankly, we've given them usually an opportunity to make a case even after the 4 years, and you'll see that in the status reports. And I'll leave it to the board as to whether we want to firm that up or not.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Mr. Richard.
Just one other quick question. I don't want any specifics to embarrass anybody, but what percentage of these are kind of half-baked, to put it, you know?
They're what?
Kind of half-baked.
Oh, really, they're all excellent projects because they were approved by the board.
Oh, okay.
Approved by the agency.
Thank you, Mr.
I
Chairman.
That's a good answer.
I do think that as we move through this, I recognize there is an interest on some new applications. I mean, as we move through and start to look, we can refine this as we move forward, and especially as we start to look at some of these projects and potentially shifting money. And most importantly to me, somebody came to us with a real project and said, if you had a match, we had the match, we'll go now versus some of these. I think there's some within this program, I want to see projects happen versus the potential.
No, I don't want to prolong the conversation, sir, but many states, part of their criteria, and this would, you know, we have to go into a little bit of conversation on it, is they require sponsors to come with a project that's already been through engineering, land acquisition, and is ready to go to construction, for example. You know, there's a lot of different things we could talk about.
I think these are the types of things, when you say half-baked, but you know, just, it's really about this program exists for a reason, and we should be putting that money on those projects that are viable versus thinking about the fact that $70 million right now is sitting out there of $190 million that has not been used. So, as Mr. McCarthy pointed out, I mean, it's allocated whether we have to set this money aside for it, whether we like it or not. So,
Yes, Ms. Lauder.
How much of the funding and the oversight of the projects is dictated by the federal government? In other words, when Rich mentioned about, Jim mentioned about half-baked, I mean, some of this, from what I have gathered, and may be an incorrect assumption, is a lot of this is directed by the federal government as to how certain things will occur. So I'm just wondering how much percentage is federal-directed ways of doing projects, and how much leeway do we have in the state?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lauterbach, from a selection standpoint, each state can identify how they want to attack the program. There are 12 categories, and the only thing the feds require is it has to have a relation to surface transportation, so it has to have a relationship to transportation, and it has to meet one of those 12 categories. If this board said we only want to fund this specific type of project under Category 3, that would be up to this board to say that. Now, once you get into projects being selected and the processes they have to follow, Federal Highway Administration does set all the parameters from an environmental documentation, contracting rules, things like that, as far as what the sponsors and local governments have to follow through from a process standpoint.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that's one of the surprises that the locals get in implementing these projects is these things that they have to live up to for the procurement and the additional requirements from the federal government. You run into that. They get a shock constructing the project when they get to that phase of it. So I know that we cover some of it in training, but for some reason they forget it from time to get from training until they start putting the shovel in the ground. So it's a challenge, I know.
Yeah, in fact, sitting on the other, in another dais in another life, I couldn't help but notice there's a whole bunch of Prince William projects that were just sitting there. And the same type of thing, I don't think people understood the requirements that went along with it. And to meet these requirements, you have to have a pretty fairly robust infrastructure to support support meeting all the federal requirements and our requirements, which I don't think they realize. Next slide.
Well, next slide.
Michael.
Please tell us.
Yes. That list, would that have the specific projects that have not actually been completed or started at this point, you know, those 40% that have not been done?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dulles, that list will exhaust everything that the board's allocated 9-3 forward. So it'll show completed, all the way from completed, and whether they just got money last June.
Okay.
And then they may not even be under agreement yet because the federal fiscal year hasn't started.
Okay.
So we'll, it's kind of a working worksheet that you'll see. It may be good that we talk through it a little bit. And again, I'll send it through Carol, and my contact information will be in there, and maybe we can chat individually about some of them.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Mr. McCarthy promised that this would be the last question on that slide.
Mike, it would help me a lot if somehow you could highlight any projects in my district, perhaps in everybody's district, that are past their four-year grace period, because when we adopted that four-year limit several years ago, we meant it.
Yes.
And it's a little unsettling to learn that there may be some projects out there. Maybe there's a good reason for that, but I'd like to know which ones are past 4 years, because they would be high on the list, barring extraordinary circumstances.
Well, it's in your district.
Pardon? In my district, absolutely. I'm not going to decide what goes on in your district.
We can easily do that, Mr. McCarthy. We'll make sure that's clear.
All our districts.
All right, moving on to a more on the policy side from a selection and allocation. For those who were with us in June, we had an exciting opportunity from the governor and secretary's office to look at a statewide tourism initiative with this pot of money. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but this represents that statewide initiative that the secretary helped us with this past year. The exciting part is we're taking that map of scenic roads, that's the visual up there. If you've seen that or not seen that, it's basically a beautiful map showing the scenic roads of Virginia, highlighting historic sites and tourism sites. And we're going to take that with this money and make that a multimedia electronic version of that. So when people go to a welcome center, they can specifically with the region that they're stopping in, can pull up some tourist-based information that are tied directly to our scenic roads and tied to tourism, tied to wine, tied to the Tuscan Centennial of the Civil War. You see the other ones that are in here. I won't spend much time on that. But the real issue that we're going to be bringing to the board next month as a draft policy provision is how do we continue that theme of a statewide tourism initiative on how we allocate money via the program. And the proposal that we're presenting today, and we'd like to get some feedback from the board on that, is to set aside $4 million off the top of that, we'll say it's $18 million next year. So $4 million of the $18 million would be set aside off the top for the statewide tourism initiative. Those may not go through application-based process, so those are kind of outside of the application realm as we see it. And then the remaining $14 million in my example would be taken through the process you see laid out on that table, where 75% of it would go to the district members, done the same way we've done it before, where they look at the projects in their districts and allocate that money in an equal share. And then the at-large members would look at recommendations from staff on statewide regional projects and filling gaps. Maybe there were some shortfalls in what the district members were able to fund, and look at the remaining 25% of that money. So that's what I would suggest for, in the essence of time, I guess, Mr. Chairman, is when I send the email on the status reports, if board members have specific thoughts on that, that would be a good venue to send thoughts back to me, and I can share that with the board next month as well.
And I'd maybe just make a comment about this. I mean, this is one opportunity for us to, you know, support. I mean, obviously, everything we do in transportation supports the economy, but this is an opportunity for us to support specifically the sesquicentennial 150th birthday, but obviously tourism generally. There are limited funds to support what is, you know, obviously a very large tourism draw for the Commonwealth, that is tourism, Civil War tourism, and trying to, draw in as many visitors over the next 4 to 5 years as this commemoration ends up occurring. So, and so far, I can tell you that it's, I think from, I give a great deal of credit to Mr. Estes working with the Virginia Tourism Sesquicentennial Commission, as well as others, because we're seeing synergies between the Civil War tourism, wine tourism, and obviously other amenities that are out there. Now we can end up really updating how we get out to people using the technology that exists. It's everything from PDAs and being able to get people to drive around and do tours using their PDAs to people being able to even maybe download the stuff off the web to visiting our rest stops, because the goal is to put these things at every rest stop, given that there's, what, 40 million people a year use our rest stops. And, you know, the issue is trying to get use that opportunity to market as many of those people as possible as they're running, actually hopefully when they're leaving the bathroom, not as they're running to it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just want to commend you for this. I think this is an excellent idea. I think, what is tourism, $3 to $4 billion a year here in the Commonwealth? And what a great idea. And I think it's really good. And this whole idea of maybe doing a larger project statewide makes sense. We did that when I was on the board in the 90s. You all go to Monticello and you see that beautiful stone bridge. We paid for that at $1.5 million, which enhances that whole Monticello thing. And so I think you're really right on target there.
The governor very much appreciates the board's support for this.
Which begs the question, is it CT policy, CTV policy, or is it just tradition that we allocate $1 million to each district and then the other overall? I mean, I don't want to open a hornet's nest, but I'm just trying to get...
You start meddling when you raise questions like this.
Yeah. No. I just...
You want to go into executive session? Let's get everybody out.
I tried to step away from the mic at that question.
It's just a historical perspective.
It is simply CTB policy, and historically it's been, traditionally it was split 15 ways, quite frankly, and each member had the discretion to spend that money as they saw fit.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
in the 90s, what we did is we had a special subcommittee that handled enhancement, and the subcommittee determined the allocation, essentially. So it's all been done differently over the years.
Roll the dice.
All righty. Okay. Last thing, we talked about categories. One of the recommendations you'll see in the markup policy we'll bring next month, I'd like you know, to hear from you if you think otherwise, is based on some of the change and movement. We are considering opening it back up. We had confined it to the categories you see here to start in FY13. But we're talking about returning to all 12 eligible categories and considering the applications for whatever category they fall in. And I think we've talked a little bit about next steps. Again, I'll send through Carol status worksheets. We'll put in there my contact information, email, and phone if you want to talk to me about those or your thoughts on some of the proposals you've seen today. I'll bring back in October a mock-up of the board policy, and I'll just quickly go over that with the board, if that's okay with the chairman, and ask for action in November. And again, just a reminder, the applications for the next round for federal fiscal year 12 would be in December.
You'll have to be, I guess, December. Yeah. Because we're not having a meeting in November. We're going to have actually our November meeting in December in coordination with the Governor's Transportation Conference up in Roanoke.
Okay, we can easily adjust that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just one thought. We might want to begin to consider, if we're going to be delivering this information electronically, maybe we need to rename our rest stops text stops or have us. We've had historical marker pull-offs, but maybe we need text stops. For people that just
thank you. Can we form a subcommittee with Mr. Coulomet as the chair of that committee and maybe come back with a recommendation?
Virginia loves texting, but in the right place.
Norfolk Grumman probably has some people.
Well, we would actually, I'd rather sell you. We'd call Coulomet rest stop. You pay for it.
Catchy.
All right. SDs, you're up again. Economic Development Access Program.
Talk a little, another policy discussion. I'll try to make this one a little quicker. Talk about the Department's Economic Development Program, Access Road Program. I'll go over very briefly what that program is. But the genesis of why this is on the board agenda today, and Mr. Martin can obviously speak to this a little bit. One of his counties in Bodcock County, working in partnership with several other localities around the state, drafted a letter to the Secretary asking for some relief on the speculative or bonded aspect of the economic development program. And I believe two county administrators are represented today, Mr. Burgess from Bodcock and Mr. Massengill from Dinwiddie will be speaking at public comment on this. But I just want to quickly roll through some of our perspective on that and give a quick overview of the program, what the bonded program really means, some changes, again, that we worked with the board last year on, and some suggested proposal for the board to consider. Like many of our local programs, this one is founded in code. It's a $5.5 million program a year that covers not only economic development access roads, but airport access roads, and then DRPT has a rail access piece of the program as well. You'll see the maximum allocation that a locality can get is $500,000 unmatched. They can get another $150,000 matched if they put the match up for that. The allocation is contingent on documentation of capital investment. We spent a lot of time in front of this board last year on the capital investment side, and currently that policy stands at a 5-to-1 ratio that they've got to document. You can see the date that we talked about this to the board last year. Basically, the program, the local government comes to us asking for access funds. You can either be a traditional program or a bonded program. Traditional just simply means they know who's coming to the park, to the industry, to their site development, and they've got capital documentation in hand. They can show offsets the investment from the Commonwealth Transportation Board. If they don't, some do shell buildings. Some are working with deals that aren't quite public yet, so they go through a speculative type approach where they don't know exactly who they may retain in that site, and they have, by policy, 5 years to document capital investment to support the construction of the access road. An interesting aspect of the CTV policy is after they have to return any money that's not offset by documented investment at the end of 5 years, but if they have somebody come in to that site within 2 years after that return, they can seek reimbursement for 50% of what they gave us back. A little complex dimension of the program. Very quickly on the bonded side, the big, I'd say, takeaway from this is that a locality has to put a surety out there to cover the amount of CTV allocation for that five-year period. This is, again, just a little bit of a history of where we've been on the bonded time frame. We started with 2 years. We extended it to 3 in 91, and then back in 2001, it went to 5. Recently, this was a little bit of a discussion at the General Assembly in 2005. When we came back to the board in 2006, we broadened the eligibility, and really what that did was working with counties and local governments around the state, EDA groups, we expanded from the traditional, this used to be called the Industrial Access Road Program. So this is more of an economic development access, to try to bring it up to current standard of not everything being industrial development today. Last year, we proactively worked with the board, kind of recognizing the economic downturn, and asked the board to consider increasing the amount of unmatched allocation, trying to encourage more local governments to come participate in the program, quite frankly. And we asked the board to increase that from 350 to 500. So it is currently 500 unmatched with another 150 they can get matched. And we also asked that the board, recognizing we were having a little bit of problem with getting capital investment, to lessen the capital investment requirements from a 10-to-1 as a previous requirement to a 5-to-1, which is what's currently in place, again, as of last year. I won't go into detail, but this is just a breakdown of the allocations each year between bonded, which is, again, speculative in blue, and named industry, and what I would say the burgundy or red stuff. And this is really the issue at hand, is how much money locals are returning to the Commonwealth Transportation Board every year. So these are projects that have come up through the five-year period and don't have capital investment documented, so they're having to return funds that the Commonwealth Transportation Board allocated. And what I did is I took a snapshot of those projects that were going to come due in FY11, current fiscal year, and you can see 5 projects that are coming due on the 5-year bonded period right here. And the good news is 2 of the 5 have already documented their capital investment. So we are seeing positive movement. But we do have 3 others that are coming up between now and the end of the fiscal year. One in November specifically, that any board policy consideration that this board would give would positively affect. So here's our options, basically walking them from top to bottom very quickly. No action. We can see what, again, the capital investment change from 10 to 1 to 5 to 1, and the additional money, see where that kind of brings us over the next few years. We can declare a moratorium on calling the bonds over the next 2 years, give a kind of a one-time waiver and recognition of the current environment, and say for the next 2 years we're not going to call any bonds as long as the local government extends the bond, keeps the bond active. The other ones are include maintaining the 5-year bond period but extending that 2-year window to another 2 years to make it 4 years, they can get 50% back, or just simply extending the bonded period from 5 to 7 to give folks, again, that extra 2 years. Staff's recommendation would be to not to change formally the CTB policy, but to just simply put into effect through a resolution that we would not call bonds that are due over the next 2 years, recognizing the current economic climate, and then we can come back to the board within that window and give a report on where we stand. And the board can either continue that further or we can go back to the current policy that's in place. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you.
I appreciate the work, and I appreciate Mr. Martin particularly raising this issue. Several of the communities that have bonds outstanding right now that are due this year are in the Salem District. I mean, this is not individually or in total very large amounts of money within our program. However, to these communities, most of them under some severe economic stress, it is a lot of money. And I think it makes a lot of sense for us to work with them to give more time
for them to follow through on these projects. So, Mr. Martin, if you have anything else you wanted to add?
I could only echo what you eloquently stated so well, and simply state the obvious that we would want to do whatever we can for the economy of Virginia and the localities involved. And I believe that the recommendation from the staff fits in that fine line of standing by a policy that we adopted with good principles behind it and good faith, and realizing that the realities can sometimes cause us to add that human element of a moratorium, acknowledging what the reality is today versus when we set our policy. So I would appreciate all of you supporting the recommendation from the staff.
Any other comments? Yes,
Mr. Chairman. I don't think it's a burden on the board to continue to fine-tune this policy. In fact, I think our habit of doing that, which you've helped document, is an approach that we may want to consider for our other programs as well. We fine-tune these in response to the real-world assessment of how they're working, with the intent of carrying out the program's objectives, as opposed to having such a stiff set of rules that people can't actually follow through. And that flexibility of the CDB to work to establish and adjust policies as needed is one of our challenges going forward in other programs too. I think this is a good example of how to be responsive, as opposed to how we're forced into formulas and distribution allocations and so forth, either by statute or by habit, that don't let us actually respond as well as we could. So, just speaking for myself, but also I think reflecting the board's opinion, is that we don't see it as a burden to adjust these things and to tackle these things as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCarthy.
Mike, do we have enough money in this program, or is it oversubscribed or undersubscribed? How are we doing?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCarthy, quite frankly, it's undersubscribed right now. And part of what we brought to the board last year was to try to spur on some more interest from local government by increasing that unmatched amount, try to give them more money that they wouldn't have to put their own money up to do it. And by also decreasing the requirements on capital investment, we thought it may reduce some of the risk to local governments to try to get them to subscribe more.
Okay, so you bring a resolution, or do we have to do anything?
Again, if members have things they'd like to discuss with me, we can do that over next month, but I plan to bring a resolution to bring the bolded blue recommendation as a resolution next month.
Excellent. Betsy, thank you very much.
All right. Boy, this is your day. Columbia High.
I'm getting close, sir.
You did such a great job. We might have you do them all. Mr. Page was mine, right, Mr. Page?
Thank you. All right, Columbia Pike in Arlington County. For those who have been on the board, this has been a topic that we've discussed quite frequently since last fall. And this is another one where we have an action item we're asking the board to act on at the action meeting to, for all intentional purposes, transfer this route from the VDOT system to the Arlington County local road system. And Arlington County will be here to discuss this matter a little bit at the public comment period as well. So real quick, not a lot has changed since our last update in June. I've got a couple bullet points I'll highlight, but for the good of the new members, just very quickly, the uniqueness of Virginia you'll hear a lot about is the fact that VDOT runs most of the local road network in the counties across the Commonwealth. 95 counties. Only two of the 95 actually run their local street network, and those are Arlington and Henrico County. So that's the first bullet. The first thing to take away is this is basically dealing with the Arlington County Road Network. They receive maintenance payments from the board on an annual basis, just like the cities, the 81 cities and towns who operate and maintain their infrastructure receive maintenance payments from the board. On an annual basis, that represents about $350 million that the board budgets every year for that. VDOT does operate the interstate and primaries in the county, and Arlington's request is that they want to control all operations, maintenance, and construction, specifically including the permitting, design approvals, and everything along the Columbia Pike corridor, which is currently a primary highway. Just to, again, a little bit more about the Pike. Importantly, is it is part of the primary system, but it's not part of the national highway system. A little bit of background about how long the corridor is. We do believe as staff it functions similar to other local streets within the county. Interesting enough, Arlington plays a very active role on the Pike today. Under agreement, they operate and maintain all the signals along the corridor, but they also handle the bus service, street cleaning, litter control, bus shelter, street lights, landscaping, you name it, along the corridor as if it's one of their local road networks. Just for those maybe not familiar with the area, this is generally from Bailey's Crossroads to the Pentagon is the section of the Columbia Pike we're talking about. Here's our long calendar of what we've been working through, and I really will simply say that this has been a considerable topic of discussion in front of the board, and we've worked up an agreement partnering with the county on how to transfer this. And at the June meeting, the board asked that we move the agreement deadline to get that agreement executed or approved to October. So that's why we're back in front of the board today. And there's a couple of things that we were specifically asked to address as part of our discussions with Arlington County. We have updated that agreement based on some of those discussions. I'll go over them very quickly in a second, provided to the county. And the county board has been briefed on the changes that the CTB discussed in June. So just a quick thing, what's changed? Again, the last two bullets in the slide are really the only thing that's changed since June, but for a general overview, we're conveying everything along the corridor as kind of a without warranty, quick claim deed type arrangement. Everything we have interest in, the county will have interest in after we convey that. We are retaining control of the two major primaries that are running across the corridor, Washington Boulevard and Glebe Road. And there's also some auxiliary streets that are part of the local system that VDOT has some right-of-way along that we're conveying. One of the concerns that came up earlier in the board discussions was about capacity and what our requirements would be on the county to continue to have capacity along the corridor. And you can see we've included that in the agreement. There's a financial penalty if the county does degrade the corridor by reducing the number of travel lanes. The other things you can see here talks about permits and work that we have ongoing at Washington Boulevard. But the bigger bullet was the last bullet that we were asked to address with the county last time, was limiting personal liability of our staff that are working on this arrangement.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the financial penalty, is it a one-time penalty, or is it, and is it significant enough that would make a difference?
The first question I can answer. The penalty is not set for what particularly would be an adjustment in one location. It's tied to the entire corridor, and it would be the maintenance payment associated with the corridor within the county. And that equates to a couple hundred thousand, $220,000 if you use today's current rate that they'd be receiving on an annual basis along Columbia Pike.
So it's every year going forward, not just a one-time penalty.
Like do you have criteria that establishes whether that road capacity has been compromised? Because having built the job on Columbia Pike and knowing that it's a major commute from Fairfax County into the Pentagon area going through Arlington, that's a big concern that we've received some letters on as well. So.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kaczynski, we've had a lot of discussion, quite frankly, about how to quantify that. We chose not to get into level of service discussions. We simply put into the agreement that if they reduce the number of travel lanes, so if they're currently in some sections, six lanes of travel, if they were to cut those down and not have those open to traffic, that's really our only indicator for service.
Chairman, could we put in a contingency to approve this if we get some cooperation on 66 inside the Beltway? Did you entertain them?
There'll be representatives from Arlington here. Why don't you ask them when they come up?
Has that ever been raised?
We have staff has taken the tack of keeping Columbia Pike as our focus. I know we've had some discussions at this last board about other things that are going on between VDOT and Arlington County.
Because we're being sued right now, aren't we, on 66? The 66 too, right? Inside the
no, building. I don't think they're suing us.
Yeah.
So I forget, you know, there's so many lawsuits involving Arlington. actually, they're suing us on 95, 395. They're not suing us. They've sued us before in 66, right?
I think they're here, Mr. Chairman.
Right now it's a hot lane.
They're representatives here, I think.
Okay, well, they're going to come up. Are we going to have them during the resolution?
Mr. Chairman, during public comment was the plan. We can do it as you wish.
Folks from Arlington, why don't we just deal with it now?
We'll deal with it now?
Yeah, why don't we just deal with it now?
Well, why, Dennis, are you going to do it? Or
you want to hear the
who's, I think just, well, I think folks just want to understand, again, the first off, I guess, assurances regarding capacity.
Good morning. This was going to be in my comment section this afternoon, but we'll move it up. We have worked pretty rigorously with VDOT over the last 2 years. We have a multi-year improvement program targeted for Columbia Pike, which actually improves traveler capacity for all modes. We offered board members a tour. We will be adding left-hand turn lanes, reducing curb cuts, adding secondary streets to really make that operation of Columbia Pike much more efficient than it is today. And in the agreement, there is a commitment to preserve four through travel lanes from end to end, from the Pentagon to Bailey's Crossroads. We operate the road today, essentially. All the signals, the traffic cameras, the fiber optic lines, all of the bus service are things that we work on. So we care deeply about the functionality of this roadway. I would also mention that as we go through our next 6 years of improvement program, Fairfax County, the Department of Defense, VDOT, and BDRPT are really critical partners for us. And we meet with them very regularly. So you have that commitment from Arlington, the DOT in Arlington. We suffer when that road doesn't function. Can I answer any other questions?
Am I next? Yeah. Are you all suing us on the improvements we're trying to do inside the Beltway to add another lane? I think it's just westbound, right?
There is no activity on that. We are cooperating with VDOT, reviewing plans.
So you're not opposing that?
I can't speak to our county board's views on that particular project, but there is no activity to my knowledge.
Because that would get people off, cutting through Arlington if we keep them on 66, right?
Yeah. And my understanding is that that project is progressing. It's in construction.
Well, I think actually that there are three different phases on 66 improvements inside the Beltway. One, phase one is underway. Phase two, that was a lawsuit, right? But phase three, we have to do certain studies for phase two and three?
We have to do some studies for phase two and three. Rick, would you like to present, update us on those studies?
Yes. He's the head of the Transportation Department here at Arlington.
Okay. Yeah. It's good to see Rick. I haven't seen him in years.
Yeah, good to see you. We haven't aged at all, have we?
No.
Mr. Chairman,
I'll leave that one alone.
there was litigation, is litigation, that's been filed over the spot improvements on I-66, but it was not filed by Arlington County. It was filed by three citizens. I think there were two Green Party candidates running for office up there that filed. Judge Hilton has ruled against them, has granted summary judgment, but I believe that's been appealed to the Fourth Circuit. So that case is pending in the Fourth Circuit. The spot one improvement is underway. The spot two and three, I'm not sure here. Perhaps somewhere from Northern Virginia, but I'm not sure if the NPO or NBTC passed a resolution making their approval of spots improvements 2 and 3 contingent on further studies being conducted in that quarter, and those studies are underway.
So it's holding us up a little bit.
So hopefully spots 2 and 3 will be moving forward sometime in the near future.
How much of a delay are we getting from the studies?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not really sure. I don't know if there's anybody here. Renee, do you know anything about those?
I'm working on those.
Come on.
Renee Hamilton from Northern Virginia. Right now we are continuing to move, as Rick indicated, on spot 1, spot 2, and 3. We are working towards the study, and there's a delay associated with that, as well as in the past with the funding aspects of it, but we're still moving along as in Northern Virginia.
Could you identify 1, 2, and 3 for me?
I don't have the specific location.
Roughly. Is 1 the Dulles Toll Road coming in?
1 basically is going from Spout Run into, I guess it's right near 29 in that area. The other two spots are further on the west.
And we got some federal money for this, right? Earmarks
that are
just pending as well. I don't want to belabor it, but I think this is so important. And Doug knows this for the Northern Virginia area. There's no place other way to get in and out, and especially for national security. I was in Washington during 9/11, and God forbid if we have another thing. I mean, people just couldn't get out of town, and so it's an extremely important project. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, again, go to the board. That was Dennis Leach from Austin County Department of Transportation spoke first, and then Renee from VDOT in Northern Virginia District. What we're asking at the action meeting, again, I think the county will come up and speak during public comment period, is that the board authorize the commissioner to execute the agreement that we've been working on with the county partnership, and to also take action. So the resolution in front of the board at the action meeting will do two things: authorize the commissioner to enter into that agreement, and we'll also transfer Columbia Pike from the primary system of state highways into the local road system. We'll then come back to the board in October to adjust it financially from the maintenance payment standpoint accordingly. So with that, sir, that's my presentation.
That's the great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your time this morning.
This is a rail update. Mr. Page, BRTC.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. For you new members, welcome. I'm Kevin Page, Chief of Rail Transportation over the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. Work for Thelma Drake over in the corner there. I have a presentation I'd like to give you today on the just a periodic update, as we have, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, coming in about every quarter or so and providing you all with an update of our rail activities within the system. Today's presentation, I'm going to talk about some of our project overviews. We've had some major milestones, some things that this board needs to be aware of and conscious of the great ambitious initiatives that we've taken in Virginia here and moving forward both our passenger and freight initiatives. And also want to talk a little bit about where we're headed in the planning process, not only for our federal program, which you all are very familiar with under the stimulus, and as the Obama administration is moving forward with its federal program for high-speed rail, but also talk a little bit about the Senate Joint 63 study and also our Virginia-North Carolina Rail Compact Commission underway. Many of you might have heard about some of the activities that live up in Northern Virginia. We finished up over Memorial Day weekend a major project initiative with our partner CSX. They were the constructing party, and we were a participant in the funding of this project. But the Alexandria Bridge project was a Herculean effort on behalf of CSX and in cooperation with Norfolk Southern as well. This is where CSX actually crosses over top of Norfolk Southern near a location called Cameron Run up in the near Franconia. This is part of one of our six projects that were just recently completed, which allowed us the opportunity to have four train slots purchased under the VTA 2000 projects, which this board has been very patient with the Department of Rail and Public Transportation and our rail partners as to how we've gone about developing those projects. The Alexandria Bridge project was about a $14.4 million project that Virginia participated in, about $4 million of rail capital bond proceeds from that as well. As you all are aware, the Lynchburg train started, of the two trains that we actually were the major milestones of Virginia, because we now participate in, as the 15th state, with Amtrak in providing regional train service in America. Our second train was started on July 20th from Staples Mill Station. It leaves daily during the week at 7 a.m. This gives us, out of Richmond, a 5 a.m.-ish departure when the Silver Meteor runs on time in the morning, then a 6, a 7, and an 8 a.m. regional train departure out of Staples Mill Station. So you're pretty much guaranteed between 6, 7, and 8, you'll have three trains that will leave on time to go to all the way far north as Boston on two of the trains and one to New York. This project here was a great effort for us. It allowed us to actually tap into some of the capacity that VDOT had at the time. VDOT worked with DRPT to help provide project general project management at the site, as well as CSX and Amtrak were also partners both in the construction and also ultimately the operation of the project. Just a little highlights here, a couple of slides showing the improvements. And then the final end result was, as we built through our project, a new fifth track to hold the train that we're running out of Richmond, as well as we relocated an employee parking lot and actually made improvements to the maintenance facilities there as well. So on July 20th, we started the inaugural trip. You'll have emailed to you today the ridership reports that we send out monthly to the board members, which will include not only the Lynchburg train, but also some Richmond train performance as well. Another major milestone, our very first rail enhancement project, the number one project of the series that were funded back on December 15th of 2005 by an action of this board, is the Heartland Corridor Initiative. This was a multi-state initiative that started in Reichenbacher, Ohio, went through Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Virginia, and how we moved through that project was a very collaborative effort. That included FHWA funding through the Eastern Federal Lands Division of just under $100 million. Of this project, the four-tunnel project that the Rail Enhancement Fund helped fund, we participated in $9.75 million, and then there was a $5 million grant through a federal earmark also for the tunnel project. It was a great ceremony on September the 9th. This actually opens up the coal fields corridor, the coal main line for Norfolk Southern, all the way through to Ohio, and it trims off 1.5 days of travel time for their corridor. So this has been a great opportunity. It's a huge economic engine for us here in Virginia because it grants us basically through Norfolk Southern almost a direct pipeline to the Midwest from our ports in the Hampton Roads area. Just want to kind of bring back to the board a little bit of our relevant planning projects at the federal level. You all are very familiar. We just went through the Southeast High-Speed Rail Tier 2 project public hearings. We continue to mature that program and that document. September the 10th, we wrapped up our public hearings. We had four in Virginia and four in North Carolina. The ones in Virginia, I will say, went much better than the ones in North Carolina if you've been reading the press. So we might end up having the rail line successfully plotted from here to the Virginia line. North Carolina will have to do some adjustments to their end. Our Richmond to Hampton Roads document
explain that last comment. So what's happening
in North Carolina? Thank you. In North Carolina, downtown Raleigh, there are two alignments. One that would basically have a direct impact on Norfolk Southern in their operations in downtown Raleigh. And the second alignment that was also the alternate alignment was utilizing the old CSX line, the old S line as it goes into Raleigh. That has been somewhat contentious as well as along some of the routing through Wake Forest and other areas where assumptions were made by the engineering team as going through the planning process, where now that's gone to public comment, there needs to be some adjustments made. So we'll have a potential pause and delay in the project as we go back with North Carolina in their territory, not ours, but in North Carolina, to rethink how some of the alternatives have been plotted through those communities. Otherwise, in Virginia, we're doing quite well. We did have one property owner come up where that there's 3 miles of right-of-way on the S line that's actually privately held that we need to deal with, and we're working through that process as well. Thank you for that question, Mr. Chairman. Our Hampton Roads document, we're working through the FEIS part of that document. We are in the process now of reviewing the chapters for the final environmental impact statement, which will go to the Fed for approval. So we continue to work through that as well. Just kind of an overview slide here, a lot of information, but just the highlights of it are, is that we're trying to then set the pace at the federal level as to how we'll prioritize our improvements through Virginia, and also how we move forward with the reestablishment of the rail line, the S line. Obviously, Richmond, Virginia to Washington is one of our key and critical aspects. That's the extension of high-speed rail to Richmond. Then from there, it will go to Petersburg on down to Hampton Roads, and also to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then using the North Carolina FRA-funded high-speed corridor from on over to Charlotte from Raleigh as well. Everything is subject to funding, as we all know, and we also need to have intense coordination with our partners, both at the federal level and all the way down to local property owners. Another historic moment that took place this summer, July 12th, we had the first inaugural meeting of the Virginia North Carolina High-Speed Rail Commission Compact. As you can see there, we have two senators and three delegates that represent the Commonwealth of Virginia on this compact. Senator John Watkins was elected as the chairman of the compact. It was a very ceremonial moment more than anything, but we gave a presentation, DRPT did, which left the compact with some thinking points. And I won't go through all of these, but I have provided them in this document presentation for you to look at a little bit later. One of our major challenges, I will point out, in the federal process and program is that now on the Continue Forward program, ERA stimulus was 100% money. Now we have an 80-20 program where the Commonwealth of Virginia or its partner in North Carolina, if we develop all the way through to Raleigh, we will have to participate at a 20% level in the federal grant-making process. On top of that, we have a 20-year maintenance requirement. We have a 20-year commitment for performance. If we fail to perform, we have to pay back the federal government a proportionate share as per the terms of the agreement. So there is a risk. There is a payback provision. There's a long-term maintenance obligation. And how we move forward with that, obviously, is something that the compact needs to be very cognizant and aware of, and something that, obviously, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation will walk this board through as we go through the risks of the endeavor that we're about to undertake. We also have, obviously, the sequencing of individual projects. We have split this quarter up into major project sections, Washington to Richmond, Richmond to Petersburg, Petersburg on down to Norfolk, and then Petersburg to Raleigh. So those are where we need to have some thought process, both at this board level and also at the compact level as we move forward. Just to bring you then, again, to a more current day, August the 6th was the deadline which the Department of Rail and Public Transportation submitted two applications to the federal government for the federal fiscal year 10 high-speed rail program applications. They had about $2.345 billion available. 77 applications were filed for $8.5 billion. Again, this is a project, an application of oversubscription of applications versus available funding. Richmond to Washington, D.C. was our quarter project that we applied for. That's to advance the Tier 2 environmental impact study and preliminary engineering on this project. Remember, we just finished the Tier 2, and we're moving towards the FEIS I just talked about south of Richmond. This is to take us through the Richmond area improvements all the way north to Washington, D.C. This is the go-to build-it environmental document that will be produced for our $1.8 billion program of the 19 projects with the 26 components to take us north. Virginia's applications were required a 20% match. Of the $11.077 million match, CSX came to the table and offered a pledge of about just under $3 million of their funding to be used and coupled with Virginia's funds as well. So I want to be very clear to the board that CSX was very collaborative with us in this process. They understood the situation that the Commonwealth was in during these economic times, and they came to the table to also assist us in this endeavor. Our second application was an individual project application as well, and that's the Appomattox River Bridge preliminary engineering for the replacement of the bridge down at the Appomattox River. Right now it's a single-track bridge on a two-track railroad, which ultimately will be a three-track railroad when we build out the high-speed rail corridor line. This bridge has less than 10 years of lifetime on it. This bridge is also going to be utilized by our Norfolk train service, as you all are very well aware of. As we move forward with the Norfolk extension, we will have to be working on making not only the capacity improvements that we've already programmed in the six-year program, thanks to your action, between Petersburg and Norfolk, but to add additional frequencies over the first frequency that CSX is allowing us to operate, the trains 2 and 3 across the corridor will need to start looking at the capacity choke point issue of the Appomattox River Bridge. Of this $1.5 million application and project, the $300,000 match is being provided 100% by CSX. So again, CSX has come to the table as a collaborative working partner with the Commonwealth, and this is just the spirit that we're seeing as we've moved forward with the framework agreement that we entered into, and thanks to this board's approval as well back in 2009. So it shows that our framework agreement process is working. We continue on that incremental approach. As I've mentioned earlier, we started with the BTA 2000 funds. We've moved through those incremental improvements that has led us to the purchase of capacity. Now we're operating Amtrak passenger trains and also commuter trains on that capacity as we move forward. And then again, in every region, we continue to look across the state as to how we will further continue to develop passenger rail service and also our freight rail programs as well as resources become available. Again, we want to give you just a brief overview at this point about our $75 million project, which was 100% federal funded as part of the $1.8 billion projects that we had forward, that we were moving forward with in our quarter program. Arkandale's Powell's Creek project is an 11.4-mile project. Quantico, the town of Quantico, is pretty much dead center in the center of that 11 miles. We have moved through, we're kind of now to the point where we've provided FRA with the significant documents that they've requested of us. Now we're starting to receive those comments back from them. The environmental assessment has been completed. Our cooperative funding agreement drafting edits have been submitted back to FRA. FRA also has suggested a project design modification. They've asked us to put an additional crossover at Arkandale. Unfortunately, FRA is not offering additional funding, but we're going to have to work through that as a condition for the award of the program at our expense. We did have 8 design build teams. We're working with BRE on the design build of this project. 8 design build teams submitted proposals with a very favorable response. And also, we have to work with FRA to make sure the absolute obligation date of this funding is $75 million. All details have to be worked out, and we have to be under contract with FRA by September 30th of 2012. Richmond and Hampton Roads, I've talked a little bit about that already, about how Richmond and Norfolk extension, you know, we're going from Richmond to Petersburg with the first train with no additional improvements with the exception of the connection track. Also, CSX has been very cooperative with us as that as well, as we've worked with Norfolk Southern to develop a program of projects, which is in a 6-year program as we've moved forward under the board's adoption of Alternative 1, which also allowed us the opportunity to bring up some conventional rail service. So you can see on this map right here before you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, you can see in the yellow highlight the routing of the Norfolk train. Today we're taking that train down the existing Amtrak corridor, which is the CSX, former Atlantic coastline, from Richmond to Petersburg. I know that there's been a great discussion both at this board level and with the community about the Richmond area improvements necessary to bring these trains through Main Street Station. So we've had a lot of intense meetings with the City of Richmond and the Richmond region. We continue to keep that dialogue open and to also work through the needs of what needs to be done both at Main Street Station and also the improvements of how we get there. The routing again is Richmond Staples Mill Station, Petersburg's Ettrick Station, and Harbor Park downtown Norfolk Station. Under the short-term Norfolk Southern proposal, which is to bring these 3 train slots up, which is already programmed in the 6-year program, as you can see, there's a red line down there as you go down the Petersburg to Norfolk corridor and then over from Suffolk to Norfolk. One of the challenges we have is under Alternative 1, which you see in blue with those white dotted lines, the white dots in the blue line, is that there are no tracks today on the high-speed rail corridor Alternative 1 that's been adopted through this region. However, under Norfolk Southern's proposal, they're allowing us to use the former Norfolk and Western line, not the former Virginian line, which is the blue line, as to how we will get basically from Kilby through Suffolk, Chesapeake, and over to Norfolk. So as we move forward with this project, I want the board to be aware that Alternative 1 does include a proposed train station at Bowers Hill, which is in the city of Chesapeake, Mr. Ellis. I wanted to call that out to you. However, the challenge is the red line goes through the Dismal Swamp. So it's very difficult for us to put a station in that location in Chesapeake at this point in time, but I'm very clear that the Bowers Hill station is part of the Alternative 1 proposal and we'll continue to work forward in the federal planning process to make that happen. Kind of in summary, we also, now that we're running Amtrak trains, that service comes at a cost to the Commonwealth because we're a funding partner and contracting partner with Amtrak to provide these additional train services. We then, from Senator Yvonne Miller's Senate Joint Resolution, she was a patron for SJ63 directed our agency, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, to study the funding of high-speed intercity passenger rail operations in the Commonwealth. This is a very key and critical point because Section 209 of PREA, which is the enabling legislation at the federal level, which allowed Amtrak to grow, established a high-speed rail program, and also delineated that all train services of distances less than 750 miles will be conveyed off to the states. So we have our two passenger trains that we are working on today, and with the extension to Norfolk included in that, as well as we're working through the federal process of understanding what the Section 209 costs are going to be to Virginia. For those of you who are curious, the trains that are impacted on this are the two trains out of Richmond that we're not funding today, plus the two trains out of Newport News that are not funded today. They are provided. They are regional service trains that are provided by Amtrak as part of their normal operating system, which is unusual for Amtrak today because most of their regional trains are actually paid for by the states. So we've been enjoying, for the entire lifetime of Amtrak, regional train service in Virginia we have not contributed to. So now the federal program has changed due to the change in the federal law, and we're now having to work through the process of picking up those trains as a cost. So we've gone through a public survey on the Senate Joint 63 report. We're in the analysis process and drafting process. We'll be coming back to the General Assembly and on schedule with the deadline. Ms. Drake has worked with me a schedule that she feels comfortable with. We'll probably be bringing this back to the board next month for an overview and also sharing that document with them. So, Ms. Drake, you might have a few comments about that as well. Thank you all very much. Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the floor back over to you or Ms. Drake for questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you for such a complete overview. It's been a very busy agency, and particularly with rail, and we are very interested in bringing you the SJ63 next month, as Kevin's talking about, so you can see proposals. That's just about completed.
And I'm sorry, I just want to make sure everyone understands could you just slowly, sorry, Mr. Page, this is why I always love Mr. Page. He can get through so much material so quickly. Are you sure you're not from New York?
No, my father was an oil man and an auctioneer, so.
Kevin, could you just really walk through to the board what may happen next year and how much money we talking about if we are then have to undertake all the costs for supporting Amtrak in the Commonwealth.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will slowly give you the best information that we have available today. To begin with, I'll reflect back to what's in the six-year program today. We have our cost of operations for the Lynchburg, Richmond, and Norfolk train subsidy. That's just what we're paying for on the trains that Virginia contracts today. In the six-year program, we're about $51 million. What we could significantly see on October of 2013 is that we'll be picking up the expenses of four additional trains. Those are two we're paying for today at $53 million. The four additional trains obviously can be, and I don't want to throw a dollar amount out yet, but we will see that this number probably over double. And in addition to that, we will have a capital charge that will be passed on to from Amtrak to Virginia, what they call a capital charge for equipment, that could be ultimately, and their proposal today is running roughly around $5 million per year. That will also be attached and coupled to that cost stream. So that's very challenging for us because we may go from, say, $6 million a year to $13 to $14 million for operations plus another five to six on top of that for the capital charge for the use of the equipment that's in the corridor. There are 27 trains, they call them trains, train sets, that are used for the regional service that we pull from. We have two trains a day that go north and two trains a day that come south. So we use four of the 27 trains in rotation every day. So we will be, the Commonwealth, will also be funding the capital charges, that's where this capital charge comes from, of the 27 train sets that are shared with Virginia, Pennsylvania, some of those I think go into New York State and also Vermont and Maine on that service.
So we're going to have to potentially support with capital money trains that, that just simply operate in Virginia that don't necessarily
to simply stay within our borders.
That is correct. But just in brief summary, there is a value to the Commonwealth for the connectivity to the Northeast Corridor because we have the opportunity to share equipment with other states. If we were, for example, North Carolina has their own dedicated train sets. They have a baggage car, so their fleet is dedicated. They will be paying 100% of the equipment charge for those two train sets, where we, Virginia, will be sharing the cost of train sets with the other states. So it helps dilute the impact to a certain extent because we're sharing those costs. However, the connectivity to the Northeast Corridor, again, gives us a single seat ride out of Virginia right into Boston. So there are ups and downs, positive and negatives, to our connectivity to the Northeast Corridor. But at the end of the day, we will be partnering with other states in this capital charge.
Okay. Explain then also the potential operating costs.
Operating costs?
Yes.
The challenge on the operating costs today is that Amtrak used to charge the profit and loss statement that we're operating under today in the six-year program is a direct profit and loss. They do not share with us or pass on indirect costs such as general administration and overhead and depreciation and cost of equipment. Under PREA, under Section 209 of PREA and how the new Amtrak system is designed and delineated under Section 201 of PREA, the fully allocated costs, both direct and indirect costs, will be passed to the state. So we will pick up an indirect cost charge that is not today under our program, plus the capital and equipment charge on top of that. Our challenge with Amtrak has been getting good numbers out of their new cost allocation proposal, because what they're doing is all the way up the Northeast Corridor and system-wide, if they have a chief engineer in Oakland, California, that has an individual somewhere in the Northeast Corridor that may touch that train, they're trying to indirectly bill us or assign a value to that engineering supervisor out in Oakland, California. So what we're doing now is by line item, Mr. Chairman, we're in an intense disagreement as a nation with Amtrak as to how they are working forward with their process. Amtrak's board has very clearly passed their own policy, which they have passed on to the states, and what I've just gone through in detail for you in a general way. We have until October of this year to come to closure, the governors of all the states and the mayor of D.C. with the president of Amtrak. I do not see that happening. So what happens after that is the next step is it goes to the Surface Transportation Board. The Surface Transportation Board will then go through the complaints filed by the states, the disagreement, and also try to establish a costing program that will work for the states and also work for Amtrak. So they're going to have to mediate this. We probably will see this happen, and we will keep the board briefed as we move forward. But as I go forward with this, Ms. Drake's bringing forward as well needs numbers as to the best we can determine that we will be impacted by this service. If Virginia does not come to closure with this service October 2013, or we cannot afford the services 2013, we will see four regional trains plus the two we operate. We'll see six regional trains in Virginia not operate because of the new law when it becomes effective.
And
I just wanted to add to that I think we're going to know a lot more by the end of next week. Right. There is what's called a SCORT committee meeting. Is it Jacksonville?
Yes.
Next week? And even a conversation as recently as this morning with Amtrak. They didn't seem to think, Kevin, that they had to have this done by October of this year, and I pointed out to them that is our interpretation. So their comment back to me was, by the end of next week. And what we've asked for is much better understanding of the numbers and to be able to feel like we're being treated fairly. Certainly we don't want to put them out of business, but we want to feel that we're not paying the full cost of this.
Now, and just to build on that, I mean, it's all right, we're going to have to pick up operating costs. The question now is just how much. But structurally, we right now don't have a way to support them with operating costs. Could you please explain that to the board?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I want to just briefly give you an overview, especially the new members as well. We have a very good capital funding program here in Virginia that this board has obviously the funding control over. We have a rail preservation fund, a rail access fund, which we share with Mr. Estes. He went through just a few minutes ago. Rail preservation is funded on an annual basis with some highway funds that are transferred over. Rail enhancement fund is a dedicated revenue source where we have actually codified the Code of Virginia. We have a freight passenger capital improvement program called the Rail Enhancement Fund, where we use the tax revenues from rental car taxes. Now, our challenge is that even if, well, first of all, we have no revenue stream, but even if we did have a revenue stream, we need to have a pipeline or conduit in the code, which would be a passenger rail operating fund. Then we have to identify where those funds come from. Today, we have no funding that we can identify under the way the Code of Virginia is established. We're not in the Transportation Trust Fund. We don't pull dollars out of that for rail. There is no rail provision in the current Highway Transportation Trust Fund allocations, as in the Code of Virginia, nor does the language of the Rail Enhancement Fund afford us an opportunity to actually provide passenger rail services. So our challenge here is that we need, first of all, the mechanism in place for we need to establish a passenger rail operating fund. And then as a concert to that or a parallel move, there has to be some funding put into that program that will obviously set up a sustainable source of revenues as we move forward. Otherwise, we'll see a dramatic impact in the state. We will lose the Lynchburg train, we will lose the Richmond train, and we'll also lose all of the regional service, which are the four trains that I mentioned that go up the Urban Crescent from Newport News all the way through to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin, back to your, I think it's slide 11 on the compact. Can you give me some idea of how these developments might fit with the calendar that we were just talking about with train service? In other words, if we advance on this set of issues, is it going to overlap with these same type of financial decisions we have to make on the regional and other passenger service?
That's a very good question. Thank you, Mr. Coulomb, and Mr. Chairman, members of the board. What we're working through on the points of discussion for the compact is, and just to fall back, the $1.8 billion 19 project proposal that Virginia submitted to the federal government and the one that we continue to develop, which is our next step, Richmond to Washington service, does not call for increased passenger trains. That's the good part of this. So because we anticipated under PREA, we kind of saw this coming. You know, I hate to say that, but we saw the light at the end of the tunnel headed our way. We knew it was going to come out sooner or later. Amtrak had, you know, obviously plenty of time to start these negotiations. They began them in April when we have until October to really kind of before this goes to the STB. But we'll see how that goes with what Director Drake just mentioned. We're talking a capital program. Once the high-speed rail corridor is established and developed to Raleigh, we have four more trains that we will have to pick up, high-speed trains. That's to answer your question, as the compact moves for high-speed rail to Raleigh, we have four additional round-trip train trips there. As the compact or the Commonwealth moves to high-speed rail under Alternative 1 to Norfolk, we have a maximum of six trains. We'll have three that we're actually going to extend. That those trains we will pick up under 209, which are the Richmond trains. We'll move those to Norfolk. But after that, there's an additional three trains we'll have to pick up at that point. Plus, we have plans also to add one more frequency to Newport News.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Davis.
Kevin, I was trying to read between the lines with what you're saying. As far as funding goes, is it not correct that to have a dedicated source of revenue to satisfy the needs and the requirements that are placed on you, that this will require a legislative action creating funding for this purpose?
The answer is yes, to a great extent.
Mr. Chairman, does that mean then that the CTV needs to request to the General Assembly that they address that issue and assist us in doing what the people of the Commonwealth have been demanding of us to provide rail service?
I think that'd be fine. We actually already have drafted up some legislation to include in the governor's package, but I think actually the CTB taking a resolution in that regard would be helpful. So if we can bring that back to maybe shoot for the December meeting. Mm-hmm.
We also have our federal legislation, Mr. Secretary, that we given to you to ask members of Congress to deal with this PREA issue as well. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was really going to be my point, is there is a major commitment that needs to be made rather than a start with we just hope something will turn up in the next few years. Mm-hmm. So if we are going to take it seriously, it will take a major new commitment by the Commonwealth.
Well, there's I say December, because the House Transportation Committee and the Senate Transportation Committee have all agreed to have meetings during that the same time period we're going to be up there.
Mr. Chairman, just as a point, so this money is operating cost and to keep this operation going, then is, for lack of a better term, is it a subsidy to Amtrak, because we're not getting any revenue from this? This is a state funds going in to help subsidize or help the operation of Amtrak?
Yes, sir. Thank you for your question, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Just as a follow-on to that, we've got a unique anomaly. Our Lynchburg train actually covers all of its losses at this point. So in that case, which has been kind of an unusual discussion we've been having with Amtrak, is what do we do with the excess revenues? And but all other train service in the United States does not make money. It's very seldom that you ever see intercity passenger rail operations pull their profit and losses out. Under the new PREA legislation, under 209, we will not be running in the black on that train, because we will be picking up indirect costs as a follow-on. So this will be a straight subsidy program, very similar to what you see with the Mass Transit Trust Fund. Our bus systems in Virginia operate the same way. It's deficit financing of operations and capital.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up, what is our current ridership now? I mean, for the trains that are running, you mentioned Lynchburg and all, is that what the percentage or what kind of ridership do we have?
You'll have the detailed report in your email this afternoon. Okay. I don't have it with me, sir, because they were still finalizing that this morning, but it will be coming to you in your email this afternoon.
Thanks.
But, Kevin, it is important to tell him that Lynchburg is double the ridership that was projected. That's why it's
right.
Doing so.
Yes, thank you.
I know you said you are getting good numbers out of Amtrak, but one of the things I think we should consider is their performance, because the four trains out of Newport News are less than 50% on time. And you know, in terms of negotiating costs and their efficiencies and stuff, in fact, that was one of the questions I had. Has our schedule changes made any difference in that efficiency out of Newport News?
Well, if I can answer the question, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we're continuing to monitor that. And what Mr. Lane is speaking of is actually we changed the schedule of one of the Newport News trains so that it was meeting the other train down near Providence Forge. What happened was the CSX went into a major maintenance and overhaul program towards what we call the end of the construction season, which is wrapping up right now. So the on-time performance of that train is still challenged, but it's because not now where the trains are meeting. It's because they're still slowing down for maintenance crews on the line. So this winter we'll probably have a better indication, Mr. Lane, but we are keeping a close eye on that. One point I want to make to this board is that when we take control, we being Virginia, take control of the subsidy operations of those trains, we'll also have better control of the scheduling and operations of those trains. I think one of our biggest challenges, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, has been these regional trains that we're not providing the subsidy for. We have no control over discussions of scheduling. We were able to convince Amtrak, since we are a good partner with them, to look at the schedules of their trains and try to work with CSX on that. And we have made some good progress on that, though.
Paige, could you just tell the board, you just touched on it here and there during your presentation, but I think people need to be aware, the board needs to be aware of the CSX agreement that Director Drake signed off on, that comprehensive agreement, what that does and why that's so important.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, the agreement the chairman is speaking to is the framework agreement, what we call the railroad agreement for the federal funding. I just want to explain to the board, back in 2009, very early, the first quarter of 2009, this board was briefed and also gave the nod of approval of a framework agreement as to how the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Department of Public Transportation, CSX, and we also have one almost identically written with Norfolk Southern, will develop freight and passenger rail projects in Virginia. It was very important for us to understand that, because the Commonwealth of Virginia has its own
program and priorities of projects. Passenger rail and freight as to what we want to do in Virginia, and the railroad, CSX in this case, had their National Gateway and other projects as well. When we went into the grant funding cycle with the federal government, they required that there be an agreement that had specific stipulations in that agreement between the Commonwealth of Virginia and the railroad. We did not want our agreement to be taken over by the federal government, the Federal Railroad Administration. So what we did was is we continued forward with our framework agreement, which has five-step functions and the process as to how we will get from basically conventional rail today through Virginia's priorities to a high-speed rail corridor as contemplated by this board and approved by this board over several decisions since the early 2000s. We have a great agreement in place. We took that, modified it, added the 19 $1.8 billion projects, put in a commitment letter from CSX, which commits that upon completion of this project, we have a 90-mile-an-hour corridor from Richmond to Washington, and also the train service that takes us to downtown Richmond.
Right, 90-mile-an-hour.
90-mile-an-hour, maximum achievable speed project.
Mr. Secretary, because it's existing rail bed, it is not new track.
Right, 90 miles an hour is obviously
super fire. Today the operating speeds, thank you, Mr. Chairman, are Ms. Drake. Today, the operating speed is 69 miles an hour. Automatic train control kicks in at 70. If the train goes 70, it makes a fast stop for protective purposes. So we're going to take the railway, ultimately, from 70 today to 90 miles an hour in designated sections. We'll still have what's called civil speed restrictions through Quantico and Ashland. That's a 45-mile-an-hour restriction. However, the framework agreement then went forward to the construction agreement, which put in all the provisions of the federal guidelines. One of the things that's come up nationally is that the Class 1 railroads, besides Burlington Northern Santa Fe, who just entered into a term sheet commitment with Washington State, there is a performance requirement in the document that the Fed is requiring. However, we did not come to closure on that because we do things a little differently through our framework agreement. The federal government is looking for increased on-time performance over 80%. So back to your comment, Mr. Lane, about some of the challenges that they have. The Federal Railroad Administration and the Class 1 railroads in Virginia's North and Southern CSX are at loggerheads right now over what is the metrics for on-time performance and how will that be metered and measured in America. Currently today, a conductor writes down on a passenger train what their passenger train delays were, but they get turned in, so the Class 1 railroad doesn't have a way to validate that. That's one of the challenges. That's the first challenge. The second challenge is that there was the Fed wanted a payback provision, a penalty clause, where the railroad, if they delayed a train for any reason, would be paying a penalty to come back. We could not come to closure with CSX or in any other state in the United States has been able to come to a commitment of that.
Okay,
so that's where we are on the framework agreement.
Stop there for a minute.
Right.
I just want the board to understand what this is happening.
Right.
The first thing is our framework is the first one in the country.
Right.
It gives us both for high-speed rail, our existing service, as well as running the new trains out of Hampton Roads. It's a great thing, and obviously moves up the speeds dramatically. But on the backside of this thing, we have this bigger issue and disagreement going on between the Federal Railroad Administration and all the Class 1 railroads, because essentially to take any of the money for high-speed rail, the railroads are going to have to commit to certain performance criteria, which they believe they cannot meet, and particularly because there are penalty provisions in there. So in our case, for $75 million, quote unquote, $75 million, our Class 1s would end up potentially facing very, very heavy penalties if, for whatever reason, a train is delayed. And so Class 1s across the country right now, and we understand, are refusing to move forward on high-speed rail.
That's correct. So our federal program is at a standstill.
Well, and Mr. Secretary, an important component of that in Virginia is that we have a 19-project corridor. So our agreement is when the corridor is complete, we would be at 90 and we would meet these performance measures. This is one 11-mile stretch. That's where our argument with FRA is coming in as to how do we just quantify that one 11-mile stretch, which part of it goes through Quantico, which has a speed restriction.
That's my home station. So
yes, sir.
Nice
you summed it up very well.
Okay. My son's on that train every day. Yes.
Back to your sequencing of projects. I mean, almost, whether it's, it can't be part, it's got to be concurrent because of your argument. You're just saying, in other words, if you take the monies for one part, but you can't, you're backed up. So it almost argues that anything we go forward with, we've got to go concurrently building it instead of sequencing or prioritization.
We've seen a little bit of progress out of SRA this week, and we're waiting for some additional information. We've put in some calls, asked for some help, and waiting to hear back from them.
So I think one of the things to keep in mind is that, because we, our folks, Director Drake, Mr. Page, have been very aggressive in really moving forward as quickly as possible on this project and this money, we've now run into a sort of railroad, I'm going to say, nightmare, because now we're caught up in this bigger policy issue about, you know, that essentially the first-class railroads, just simply the Class 1 railroads, simply don't want to be caught in, for accepting a little bit of money, having to make these, you know, comply with very, very stringent new requirements from the federal government. Which is going to, you know, until this is resolved, this is going to hold up our ability to utilize our money and use and upgrade that corridor.
Mr. Chairman, and
Ms. Stockdeans,
I've followed this, and I've been really hopeful that passenger rail, in cooperation with our Class 1 carriers, was going to work. But I've always been skeptical because of our capitalistic approach to the running of railroads in America today. It's built on freight. It's not built on passenger service. And their whole motivation and structure has been to make money by moving toward freight and leaving passenger rail somewhere else in America. But what we were doing, we were running right up against the fundamental basis of the operation of railroads in America when we're trying to put passengers on freight rail. And that's what we're trying to do. And the reason that those delays occur, for the most part, is because they have freight trains that want to go first. And they're long, and they're heavy laden. And the passenger rails go off on sidings and wait for the freight rail to go by. And so I hope we can resolve this, but I worry at this point that we may have bumped up against the fundamental roadblock that's there, is that they're freight railroads. They're not passenger railroads, and we're trying to convert them with incentives. I hope it can change, but that's the way I see it.
Yeah. And Dr. Davis, you know, they just go along with what you said. I mean, what's disappointing for us is that the Commonwealth and CSX have essentially come up with a framework which is groundbreaking in many ways. And, you know, pushes the envelope on the use of passenger trains on freight lines. And because of this, you know, this inherent conflict between what the federal government's pushing right now on passenger rail versus freight, you know, instead of us being able to move forward on something that, you know, is good for everyone involved, we're kind of, you know, we've hit a brick wall, and our folks continue to work it. But the thing is that there is this inherent conflict between, you know, trying to, you know, on lines that are built for freight and trying to push passenger services on it and do so in a safe and efficient manner. So,
and Mr. Secretary, if I could just add, Mr. Davis, we have a wonderful working relationship with CSX and Norfolk Southern. And now, if we were going to double and triple and quadruple our passenger service, I think what you're talking about would really come into play. But for right now, they have been very cooperative in bringing up service, and it was Norfolk Southern that stepped up to the plate to allow us to even think about Norfolk service in the near future. And CSX, we're using their lines, and they're giving us their money. So, you know, we do have a good working relationship. It's
Mr.
just
Chairman, I didn't mean to impugn it. We don't, because I agree. I think this is groundbreaking to get a major railroad that whole majority revenue base is based on freight rail to possibly put passenger rail on that same line with greater liability and all the other concerns.
It's more slots at faster operating speed.
For them to do that is fantastic, but there is a point where their livelihood and their profitability, the stockholders and everybody, says freight comes first. And I think we probably...
And then on our side, where we're pushing more freight to try to get trucks off the road.
And in environmentally sensitive matter. So
that's our addition to the Shenandoah Valley ever since I've been on this board. We won't rail. And I always say back to them, are you willing for us to, in the Commonwealth, to invest in building railroads? Well, no. Well, then you don't want freight rail in the Shenandoah Valley or passenger rail because it's not available. It's being used to a capacity today that doesn't allow a whole lot more. So that's the discussion that's going to go on in the Commonwealth. If we want passenger rail, at some point we're going to have some dedicated passenger rail. And if we can work with the existing Class 1 carriers, we're going to have to put up some money with the belief that we can partner with them in a fair way and still let them operate as free enterprise operations. And that's going to be a challenge.
Still, Mike.
That, I think, Mr. Chairman, is why we need not only to have a commitment, we need to articulate it properly. Because this is, we can't do this incrementally from year to year. It's in our 2035 plan as a key element, and something we see needs to happen. So I agree with you. It's too serious to just wait and see how it works. We're gonna, if we have to drive the agreements, which we've done, be creative. We're gonna have to be able to articulate it to the political leadership, not just of one governor, but of many governors. And you know, that's going to take a real push. I think we can be helpful. You know, our 2035 plan begins to lay out those things that, and why it's necessary. The convincing thing for me was if we rely on 95 alone, it would have to be 24 lanes wide. That and of course, it's ridiculous. So, but the future is going to arrive, and this has to be a part of it. So I think it's a priority for us, it shouldn't be something that competes with other small ideas. This is a big idea.
I put it on the order of building the interstate system. America's faced in key urban areas, connecting urban areas, with something as great as the interstate system for railroad passenger rail to take the burden off of a lot of our major highways over the next 20 to 30 years to allow them to function the way they're supposed to function.
Mr. Rich?
I have two questions. One is, can you tell us what's going on with maybe the BRE coming into, is it Gainesville or Haymarket? What's going on there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. We have an initiative. I'm also on the BRE operations board, representing Ms. Drake. The Virginia Railway Express is moving forward with the Gainesville Haymarket preliminary engineering and design. That was a funded rail enhancement fund project agreement, Mr. Rich. We were moving forward with the scope of work. We finally worked out the terms of the match because Norfolk Southern was providing the match. And again, this is another great collaborative effort where Virginia, BRE, and Norfolk Southern have come to the table, very similar to what we just talked about what CSX is doing with us in passenger rail. Norfolk Southern is providing the engineering, some of the engineering work, and also some in-kind match for modeling and capacity work as well to actually match up that grant. So we're moving forward now under the notice to proceed procedure through our agreement. So we're just moving forward.
We could put people on the table. What is the earliest time frame?
Well, obviously, we're on the preliminary engineering end of this right now, plus the capacity planning. Obviously, funding and construction comes right after that. There aren't any funds yet identified to construct
that project. A lot of years.
Probably
we're not going to let them do anything until we finish with the 66-29 interchange.
But all of that is they're taking into consideration the rail coming in there, right, when they do the road improvements?
Well, we're doing the grade separation, which is
right.
The question really is that I think from BRE's perspective, from running another train out on that branch is going to have some certain issues with it. I think if it made sense, if we could ever get Paul Gear to sign in, we'd be going further south on the existing line.
That may be problematic.
Right. So to follow on to that, Mr. Rich, In order for VRE to serve that facility, obviously they've invested in their maintenance and overnight storage facility at Broad Run, so they would probably either deadhead out to the Gainesville Haymarket area or have to put in an overnight track at the end of the line there as well. But in the overpass, there I think there are four bays for four slots for tracks.
This sounds like a pipe dream, essentially.
Well, as we're incrementally moving forward with this, Mr. Rich, we're making sure we have up to four tracks that we can put underneath the interchange. So, again, we're making decisions today for some of the framework agreement that could ultimately be improvements that could be everlasting for 99 years. So we're moving through with that as to how we move through with those plans and our agreements.
I don't think I'll be able to ride on a train from there. Right, but Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Rich, I think that just reverting back to my former life, I'm sure the people of Prince William County would enjoy being able to put the financial commitment to provide more parking and the ability for your people to drive up to Prince William and jump on the train without having to pay for it.
I'll talk to my colleagues on the board.
That's from a former life.
We're just farmers there. We don't have that much. The other question I have is on how is this inland port doing over in Front Royal? Is that really successful?
And yes.
That seems to be an important thing to me.
It's doing outstanding. The inland port is doing quite well, and since you brought that up, I have just 1 second to talk about another NS milestone that was not part of this presentation. We're going to come back and say that for next time, but I'm going to talk about it now. The Manassas to Front Royal Riverton Junction project was completed about just over a month ago with the final improvements that Norfolk Southern made. We actually coupled with them in an initiative under rail enhancement. There's 5 miles now of double track behind the inland port, which actually allows for the inland port to be served better, because they can now park the train and not block the main line because we have a second main line now there. So, Mr. Rich, that facility is now easier to be served by Norfolk Southern, which allows us the opportunity to actually grow the business at that terminal and have the capacity on the railroad to actually serve.
Is most of the traffic, it comes in by truck from the west and then gets off there?
And from southwest and the west. Like their wood products are coming from southwest.
Does much come from the east there?
I don't think so.
Yes, very much so.
Does it come from the east as well?
It intercepts around 35,000 containers a year are now being run through, and that's in the down economy. And essentially, it is intercepting cargo all along what would have been the 81 corridor. So it's both east and west. And I think actually the last, we were just out there, and I think it's 60-40. I mean, it was actually a 50-50 at one point, you know, when you're looking at the balance. So a lot of, I mean, they're pulling containers. They built all this, I mean, I think it's a great model, one that we're, we thought there was opportunity here in Richmond, and raised with Richmond to do the same thing where the distribution centers are there. They're coming fully loaded and then just coming back empty. It intercepts the trucks.
And
if you look at the growth there in that Front Royal area, it's outstanding.
And that's under our jurisdiction, right?
The VPA?
The port.
No, it's not.
Oh, it's not? Who has that?
What's that?
Who has jurisdiction?
There is actually the Virginia Port Authority Board of Port Commissioners.
Oh,
they report to me.
Yeah, I meant it's under you.
Yeah, but it's not under the, although part of, they get 2.4% of the?
4.2, sir.
4.2? Who gets 2.4? Oh, aviation.
Aviation, sir.
Yeah, all these percentages. The 4.2 comes out of the TTF that goes to them. But we don't have a say in it at all.
Yep.
The CPP. Sorry, Director,
I just wanted to say that by our October meeting, we should have a lot more information on the Amtrak issue, on where we are with our ERA application. I just think a lot's going to happen within this month, as well as we'll have SJ63 for you to have a copy of. And we hopefully by this meeting time, because it should be in October, we'll know about our two high-speed rail applications. So we won't need to do a whole rail update, but to just bring you up to speed on what's going on with all of our biggest
issues. Kevin, I want to pose two more questions if we have time for them.
Sure.
If the Norfolk Southern route through Chesapeake and Suffolk is chosen for the high-speed rail corridor, has another station location been identified along that Norfolk Southern corridor?
Mr. Ellis, to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, The red line, as you see, is not on the federally chosen what's called a preferred alternative. In order for us to relocate the federal planning process, we'd have to go all the way back and open up the Tier 1 document and then do an alternatives assessment to actually move over onto the red line.
Okay, so that's really off the table.
To answer your question right now, unless we go back and reopen the federal planning process, Bowers Hill is the location we're proposing.
Okay. All right. And also, too, I know there's an issue with the switch in Ettrick,
mm-hmm.
you know, the changeover from CFX to Norfolk Southern.
Mm-hmm.
How's that process proceeding along to resolve
it's
that?
Going quite well. We have a preliminary engineering design. Norfolk Southern now is out in the field. I talked to one of their employees this morning. So that project's moving forward. CSX is cooperating on that as well, and there's funding in the six-year program for this year. We'll be making some adjustments to that later in today's meeting, the action meeting. We'll have a six-year program adjustment for that as well. So, yes, Mr. Ellis, we're moving forward, and CSX is that switch is no longer a conflict.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
So I'm sorry. I just want to – so right now we can – with state money, we can start up the program on the red line, but if we want to run federally supported and including the high-speed rail, we have to use the blue line.
We would have to use the blue line if we were to Mr. Chairman and members of the board, if we were to develop the high-speed corridor alternative one, it would go through Bowers Hill of Chesapeake. We can advance passenger rail today using state funds in any corridor in Virginia, which we have very quickly in the Lynchburg 29 corridor and also the Richmond-Washington corridor.
But if we ever want to use federal money, we have to run.
Right. They become a big player at the table as determining where our routing is based on the environmental documents.
Yes. I'm still not sure Kevin answered your question. On the state train that we have worked so hard to get an agreement on using state funds, that will use the red line?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Then if we extend high-speed rail, we'd have to build new track?
On the blue line. If we follow the alternative one routing, it would be the blue line, which you see, it's the old Virginian line that you see on the screen there, just above the red line.
But that would be new track.
That's a new track, yes, sir. Or rebuild the existing track where you see the little dots in the blue line. That's where no tracks exist today.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Well, you know, you have such a short presentation. We can't be up there an hour.
Well, I promised you in the prep meeting 10 minutes. I'm sorry. I went over.
Anything else? All right. Ms. Grace, thank you.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you all back.
Looking forward to coming back. It's a lot of good things to talk about.
Okay. Fund allocations. And we're going to have... Deputy Secretary David Tyer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary, ladies and gentlemen of the board. My name is Dave Tyer. I'm the Deputy Secretary and Chief Financial Officer for the Office of the Secretary, but in addition, I am the head of Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment, and for those of you who are not familiar with what the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment does, if it involves more than one transportation agency, we get involved. So we're responsible for developing VTrans 2035, the surface transportation plan and the associated maps. And we are also in the process of developing a strategic plan that the governor will unveil at his transportation conference in December. What I'm here to talk to you about today is the Office of Intermodal Planning budget or its funding. This is a relatively new piece of legislation. Began funding this office in fiscal 2007. I'm not going to ask you for a decision today. I'm just going to tell you what our plans are for allocating FY10's money, FY11 and FY12. As you can see on the slide, there's a little bit of background on how the funding has unfolded to us over the course of time. I would just tell you that there was about between $500,000 and $1 million, depending on the Annual Appropriations Act, actually allocated to the CTB to do advanced studies. The rest is for the Secretary and the Deputy Secretary in the Office of Intermodal Planning to make recommendations on and bring back to this board for its approval. So no one can spend any money without coming before this board. This is what we did with the money in FY7 and FY08. You can see the first year was a $6 million allocation. All allocations subsequent to that have been $5 million. I won't walk through them. They're pretty much self-explanatory. FY9 was the Urban Development Area Grant. That was a big initiative. And then the Advanced Activities Multimodal Grants and Performance Reports. Again, the advanced activities are those monies that are available to the CTB when we talk about advanced activities, that's any corridor or any project we want to study up until the way, up until that point where it finds its way into one of the agency's plans, the six-year improvement plan for VDOT, the 20-year plan for DRPT, the 40-year port plan, and then the associated aviation plan. So up until they find their way into one of those approved plans or programs, the activity takes place in the Office of Intermodal Planning. As I said, we have not yet allocated, asked you for an allocation at FY10 dollars or FY11 or 12. They come to us in biennials. And FY10, what we're going to ask you to do, and again, I'm not asking you for action today, we'll come back next month with an action item, is to continue advanced activities, support multimodal planning. As you are aware, there are 13 corridors of statewide significance. Only one is under study. All of them need to be studied at some point. And when I talk about being studied at some point, we have in the VTrans 2035 plan an amalgamation or a combination of all solutions in all corridors. So if you look at the 29 corridor, it has rail and it has road. If you look at the 81 corridor, it has rail and it has road. But the next step that needs to take place in this process is to take the corridors, break them down into segments, and then prioritize what is the best solution in segment X of corridor A and segment B of corridor A in that process. And that's not going to happen quickly. It's probably not going to happen in our tenure, but that's the next step that has to take place in those 13 corridors. So that's what, when you see it, multimodal planning, that's what we're doing with that money.
How much is being spent now on the Route 29 corridor?
$1.5 million has been allocated, not all of it has been awarded.
How much has been spent already that on the plan that was presented last year that had the two alternate routes for the 29 to go bypass around Charlottesville that was then taken out of the study by Governor Kane, and now we're redoing that study? Does anybody have an idea?
I have it. I don't have it with me, but I could get you a response, you know, by the end of the day or by the end of the week.
Yeah, I'd like that to go out in an email to everybody on the committee. We did this study. They came up with the proposed bypass route to 29. It was taken out before it was presented to the CTD, and it's just disappeared, and now we're starting again. That's part of our subcommittee, but I am extremely frustrated that we're going through the same process again, and we're spending more and more. We got $1.5 million set aside for it, and it's already been studied. A plan has been drawn up and presented. And then for some reason, the two routes were pulled out that I've never heard explained adequately. Thank you.
So it sounds like you actually have two. I think you actually had asked me two questions. What was the fate of the two corridors, and how much money has been spent?
Well, I know what the fate was. They were pulled out and never submitted to the CTV. The two bypass routes were included in a study that was done by VDOT. They were pulled out, never presented to CTB, and now we're studying it again, and apparently you got another $1.5 million to study it some more. Is that correct?
That's a fair synopsis, isn't it?
Okay, thank you.
Again, as part of the 2010 Biennial Appropriations Act, there was $10 million more allocated to the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment, and what I wanted to ask you for today is the recommendation for the, in addition to the FY10, is the allocation of the FY11 money as well. Now, this one's going to take a little bit different turn. You're going to see two things in this one. One for the continued support of the Multimodal Planning Office, but the Multimodal Planning Office at this point is kind of an all-volunteer army. So we can meet every 2 weeks, but those are folks who have regular day jobs. And what we need is some support staff and the access to some consulting funds. Access to consulting funds is not new. We've been doing that. And then the public-private partnership office that was one of the recommendations of the KPMG study. Again, an intermodal activity office, and they would continue to do their existing functions and but work in a multimodal fashion and be paid for from this funding stream going forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Out of curiosity, I should know this probably. Have we prioritized the multimodal studies that we, CTD, would like to have done, or is this simply a matter of legislatively mandated requirements for multimodal planning that are ongoing as opposed to being prioritized by the body making the decisions about what modes of transportation will be built?
I can answer that question. The answer is no, you haven't prioritized them because we, the Office of Intermodal Planning, haven't brought you a recommendation. One of our next steps after we complete the strategic plan would be to go through them, create some criteria, and say, this is the order. We'll hand that off to you. You can accept it. But it at least would be a straw man that you could start with as a place to begin.
Yeah, Dr. Davis, I think this is a sort of a chicken or the egg, which one comes first. I mean, even though statutorily this office was established, and even though this work has been going on, it's been ancillary to other things. And so we really would like to, and, you know, just it really create a multimodal effort here where we have the opportunity stand it up, get these studies going, and then start to look at opportunities. Doing P3s with them, to us, and being able to compare freight rail, passenger rail, transit.
Okay.
But I think the issue then would be once we get this thing standing up, coming back and say which studies are make the most sense. Personally, I think 95 and 81 would be the first two that would start.
That's why when I heard my friend Mark express his frustration, I wanted to sort of say, well, you know, if the 29 quarter folks can't agree and don't really want to agree, those of us in the Shenandoah Valley be happy to take the planning money and work on 81.
Well, and I do actually, I mean, the two corridors that we really, we need work on all these corridors, but I'll tell you, 95, since we have the tolling request, and 81, because of the, you know, the fact that that whole corridor has been left alone since the STAR solutions, and we've got to pick up how we're going to do this. Which is why one of the things that, at least on the multimodal effort, starting that, I've written to this, my colleagues, secretaries in the other states on the 81 corridor to get together in the end of October.
I met with that group when they met before.
Yeah, so this is what we'd like to do is start a multi-state effort and then also starting an intrastate effort to take a look at what we're doing. Okay.
And again, no actions today. We'll be back next month with a resolution. I ask you to approve these things. And if anybody has any questions, I'll do my best to answer.
Mr. Chairman, yes, one question. Is the fact that this is a breakout item in the Appropriations Act each year, is that a strength or a weakness? I mean, I'm a little confused about, is it need the special attention of having its own section and its own direction, or is it really a part of an overall plan and it just happens to be a budget item?
I can only speak for myself.
Okay.
But I think that there is, I mean, there's been frustration even among you all about, you know, our real ability to really judge, does it make sense to put money into a road versus putting money into a rail, or transit, or whatever. I think the same sorts of frustration exist in the General Assembly, and because they didn't see anything happen, I think they mandated that we establish it. And for whatever reason, the effort really hasn't. It's taken off in one side, but I think the issue is really trying to make this robust. And maybe if we do a good job, they'll need to put it in the appropriations out. But I'm going to have to look to the man who's been here the longest.
I agree with you.
Why I picked him as commissioner.
Well, my observation, Mr. Chairman, would be that actually that's the intent of this board going forward, is that our entire program actually should be a multimodal program, well-coordinated, you know, mutually self-reinforcing and so forth.
And I think in the long term, I mean, I, you know, the plans that we've done, I mean, we've talked about B-Trans. If people have concerns about B-Trans, they have concerns about the surface transportation plan. I think that this is, could be, this office and the efforts here could be more of a conduit for looking at these multimodal studies and making sure that we're, you know, at least putting in the, you know, sorts of criteria and evaluations that, that you all want to be able to make informed decisions about.
I agree.
So next month we'll have this back.
Yes.
Excellent. All right, well, listen, before we break for lunch, I'm going to ask if everyone actually could just grab a lunch and we'll go right into it because it's already 12:30. But before we do so, we have two members that came in a little bit late, and I'm going to ask Mr. Rich, you weren't here, but we were just, we have actually five new members that just if you just introduce yourself and Mr. Miller as well as the rest of the board.
Sir, Jim Rich, and from the Plains, Virginia, from Fauquier County, and I represent the Culpeper District.
I'm Chef Miller, I'm from Norfolk, Virginia, and I'm representing the urban area there.
Well, we welcome both of you. We welcome all our new members. What we're going to do is listen, we're going to break, grab a lunch, and then we'll start at 12:45. Sorry, 10 minutes. Okay.